Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Your name's not down, you're not coming in.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part tonight, the coming storm. As mentioned by LLMC Lance Murdoch last week, what's going to happen? The Great Reset won't be possible without a fair amount of disruption, a shock doctrine therapy for the masses. With Britain's exit from the single market at the end of December, will that be the inflection point? Democracy clashing against the oligarchy, with a collapse in the nation's finances, possibly much wider around the world. Will we see disruption and collapse in our utilities, gas, water, electricity, in travel and communications, or not? Will we see new kinds of impersonal policing to keep the population scared and indoors? If the disruption is big enough to the food chain, will some have to forage in the countryside even for food, wishing not so many badgers had been culled? Also, as foreign policy is ruled out of the final presidential debates in the United States, surely that means war is coming. They don't want to make any commitments this time. Or is it just to help Trump so he can hide his support for a coming Israeli war on Iran? Might be that simple, mightn't it? Also, the links between Aleister Crowley and the Zionists, the OTO, the Golden Dawn, and the Zionist Project, explained by Dot Joiner extraordinaire David Livingston, who talks to me about his latest book, Ordo Ab Chao, the evil killer of PC Yvonne Fletcher, or one of the greatest African statesmen of all time, bayoneted up the backside by a NATO-supported mob. The late great Colonel Gaddafi talks about US assassins over the last 50 years. And you've heard about the Bay of Pigs and bringing in the greenback dollar. Well, Gaddafi suggests another reason why JFK may have been assassinated, and that's his speech at the United Nations from way back in 2008, 2009, around about that time. I'm not sure the exact date. I'll tell you when we talk about it. But Martin, this week, lots to talk about as ever. The main thing, I suppose, we'll be talking a bit more about, I think, about the lockdown and the various measures, COVID measures, in the second hour. But this move in Wales has not gone down well amongst ordinary Welsh people at all. In an hour's time, another lockdown, all businesses closing, etc., for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, and that's the decision of the Welsh government, as you know.
Not going down well, though.
Well, they're elected
amongst ordinary people.
They're elected by the ordinary people, and if they're not happy,
they weren't elected on this issue, were they? No. This is the interesting thing: is these politicians were elected to do with basic loyalties to the parties, but they're now doing something which no one has ever asked them about.
No, I mean, what they're doing is they're agreeing with what the Sage people said some weeks ago, that a two-week lockdown was probably necessary. And in England, they're probably going to have to do a two-week lockdown or more at some point. The Welsh have decided to bite the bullet.
Well, as I say, we'll be talking about that a bit more later, including a little bit of an investigation that I've been doing into the origins of the stand-up movement and some of the affiliations of those. And what we're calling Operation Purbright Phase 2, a leaked document purporting to explain what is going on. So this is enabling us, hopefully, to put a bit of flesh on the bones of what Lance Murdoch was saying last week, the guy that did the talk about Serco. Martin, the credit rating, though, this is getting to the nitty-gritty, I suppose. UK's credit ratings have been downgraded by Moody's again. The agency's warning that growth will be meaningfully weaker than anticipated and points to problems in Britain's governance. Now, what do they mean by that, and how important is this Moody's change?
Well, if you remember, we used to have a AAA credit rating, but we lost it when Osborne was the Chancellor, because he carried out too much austerity. So he basically was saying we've got to keep our credit rating, so we're carrying out austerity. The problem with that is that it starts to push the economy down, and then you lose your credit rating anyway, which anybody who'd studied macroeconomics and understood it would have realised was going to be the case. But in actual fact, our credit rating is still, compared to many other countries, quite high. But of course there is an issue, which is the fact that we haven't controlled COVID, unlike some more successful countries.
Well, that's not why we're being downgraded, though, is it?
It is, because the economy's going down because of all the problems that we know.
You say the economy's going down, but they're basically, what Moody's are saying is that you're spending too much, the government's spending too much.
No, it's not about spending. It's about whether you...
That's what they're saying.
No, listen, Tony, it's partly to do with spending and basically running up debt, but it's also, you can run up debt as long as you've got a means to pay it back. And that's when you lose your credit rating, and it becomes clear that you can't pay up the debt back that you've already run up.
Okay, so we've lowered the rating. They have lowered the rating from AA3... to AA3 from AA2. So is that really important or not?
Not that important in the big scheme of things. And in actual fact, of course, you can actually borrow money relatively easily at relatively low rates until the crash, of course. And then money was, you know, that big. And of course, we haven't had a crash. Loads of quantitative easing.
Britain is the world's sixth biggest economy, and it shrunk by the most amongst a group of seven nations in the second quarter. Its public debt topped £2 trillion. That's $2.6 trillion, surpassing 100% of GDP. Britain's growth, says Moody's, had been meaningfully weaker than expected and is likely to remain so in the future. Whereas China, I was just reading the other day, has got something like posted about 5% growth.
Well, that's
right. In the same quarter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can now see what's happening in the global economy is that countries, and particularly China, which have actually weathered this crisis successfully, are now back to growth. Whereas the countries where they haven't managed the crisis successfully are now going to be stuck in a permanently low growth.
Britain
trajectory.
Should have been a more authoritarian state like China, should we?
It's not a question of an authoritarian state. We're talking about governance, is whether you can actually do the job properly. And of course, New Zealand is not an authoritarian state like China, and they have done the job properly, unlike us.
But there's no, I mean, we have this discussion every week, if you can call it that. It's you making a ridiculous point, which is that we were at the same state as New Zealand and that we could have done what they did. They had something like 10 infections where we had probably tens of thousands. So obviously the two aren't really comparable at all.
Well, I would argue, and it has been argued, Tony, that we could have locked down earlier than we did, because other countries did.
No, they didn't.
Our neighbouring countries did.
No, they
Ireland
was...
knocked down before we did. Well, then Northern Ireland followed.
A few weeks before, or maybe just a few days before. The World Health Organization advice came the 16th of March. Mm-hmm. So when before that should we have known?
Well, the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defence Forces...
This is the Israeli Intelligence Services. Nobody knew about that.
The Defence Intelligence Agency
of
the United States...
You know that now, but you weren't saying this at the time, were you?
No, I wouldn't, but the reason... Why do you think Britain was not told what was going on?
It's easy with the benefit of hindsight of saying these things, isn't it?
Listen. Tony, if we're going to have a serious discussion about
that's why I'm absolutely forcing you to be logical about what you're saying, because it was impossible, really, to lock down before we knew, number one, that there was a virus, and then secondly, that there was this advice from the World Health Organization. Now, Boris did flim-flam for a few days, but then he did what you would have advised him to do, and you certainly weren't saying anything at the time. And now you're then quoting intelligence services' secret reports that we should have supposedly known about.
All right, let's disentangle two things. We can talk about the what you might call the biological warfare aspects of this. Somebody in the British intelligence services, MI6, certainly will have known. Will they have told Boris? Probably not, because of course the strategy is to mess up the Chinese, let it flow back over the Western countries, including US and Britain, so that you've got an excuse to bail the banks out and carry out QE, which of course has happened, and lots of people have made loads of money out of that, and of course Trump's people were telling the people in Wall Street it is much worse than we're saying in public, so sell now, and that's exactly what they did, and that came out in the debate between Trump and Biden yesterday. So in actual fact, it's pretty common consensus that Britain's management of this crisis has been incompetent. It's not just me saying this, lots of people are saying it. And of course the figures bear it out.
In which case, it's the whole of Europe's management of the crisis that's been incompetent, not just Britain.
No, indeed.
That is all those lovely EU countries too.
Indeed, lots of countries have made a very big hash of this, and other countries, for example, Kerala.
Sweden.
Sweden
or Belarus.
Belarus is actually, it's quite interesting because, of course, nobody goes to Belarus and nobody leaves very much. So in actual fact, they're in a very similar position to Norway.
Well, they do from Ukraine and Russia.
Yes, all right. But anyway, the point I'm making, Tony, is this. There is now, after months of this crisis, it's now clear some places have done a lot better than others. We are in the not so good category.
Well, you're talking about New Zealand as doing superbly well, but the problem is, of course, that if the virus catches hold in New Zealand now, it would be much more devastating because people don't have immunity, the young people particularly.
Well, we don't have immunity in this country, and I don't think they're going for herd immunity anytime soon in China. They're going to carry on growing their economy, concentrating on building their own domestic market, and they're going to pull ahead as the rest of the world goes into depression. That is, if you mock Max Kaiser on RT, he's absolutely clear about this. This is the decisive point where the Chinese become the dominant.
Well, I thought they already were, actually.
Yes, but this is going to be the turning point where they really are, because the American economy is definitely stuffed.
So does that mean the United States wants to have a war with them now?
Well, that's pretty much what they've been flagging up, isn't it, Tony? That's the only answer, isn't it?
Well, it's the only answer if you're a bad loser, and the US does seem to be a bit like that. Yeah. Also, you look at the looking at the finances and how much it's more it's teetering on the brink now than it was back in 2008. 230 billion commercial property crashes looming. Treasury watchdog sounds the alarm as millions work from home. The value of commercial buildings is falling by about 14% this year, the OBR says. Transactions in 2020 to 21 are expected to plummet by 23%. So, I mean, this can't be sustained, can it? Actually, I think there's an enormous great commercial property bubble been built up over the last 20 years anyway.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it's only been sustained, we're only being sustained at the moment by massive QE and government intervention. So people who imagine that somehow we've escaped a crash are wrong. There will at some point be a crash. The right-wing economists are quite right about that. You can't just print money. Ultimately, it blows up. But, of course, the Chinese may be able to ride that out because their economy is growing. And if you've got a growing economy, you can service whatever debts have been developed. If you haven't, you're stuffed.
So how is this going to play out then?
Well, of course, the problem for the Chinese is that their major export markets are all going into depression. So that's their customer base disappearing. But fortunately for them, only about 15% of their GDP is dependent on exports. They're a big export machine, and they export all over the world, become the workshop of the world in the last 30 years. But in actual fact, most of their economy is homegrown. So they'll do what the United States did in the 19th century, and they will basically concentrate on developing their national economy because there isn't much happening in the rest of the world. And, of course, if you're a small developing country in the rest of the world, it'll be pretty obvious which side is winning, and the east wind will prevail over the west wind, as Mao Zedong famously said.
Well, I thought it would be useful to follow up on a report that we did a few weeks ago with Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. He's a street preacher here in Bristol. And just walking through the city centre yesterday, came across him. He wasn't actually doing the preaching anymore. He's got a court case, apparently in Swindon, coming up next year, but he hasn't been given a date for it, which suggests that it might be that the charges are dropped against him. Apparently he was being charged with harassment and racism for something that he said about Islam in reply to a question someone else asked him about. And there are all sorts of problems here with harassment, freedom of speech, when it comes to various faiths, because each faith is basically saying something different about another faith. I suppose you could say dissing another faith, Martin, couldn't you? How do we resolve this sort of problem that Sean's run into here?
Well, I mean, what it seems to me that this has been put out of proportion. I mean, he's making his speeches about his faith. Somebody asks him a question about it, and he responds to that question. People should be able to have debates about religious or other matters without it turning into a fight and into people prosecuted.
Okay, how do you separate legitimate comment about your beliefs from hate speech?
Well, that's a very good question. We could say that anybody should just be allowed to say anything. That's the easiest thing. Anybody's just allowed to say anything. And, of course, we've seen recently in France where this teacher has been basically killed because he encouraged his class to debate whether these... He didn't say these... You know, he said to Muslims in the class, you know, if you don't want to watch this, you can go out. But we're going to look at these things and discuss whether they should be allowed to be printed or whatever. But of course, if the cartoons concerned had been basically directed at the Jewish faith, then it's quite likely they would have been banned as incitements to hatred. Now, in other words, what we've got to get, if we're going to have any rationality about this, is it's got to be one rule for everybody. Now, either anybody can say anything, or we've got some rules about what you can and can't say. And that, of course, then begs questions about what is legitimate and what isn't.
Well, the fact is, of course, you're absolutely right about the laws about Holocaust denial and caricaturing of the Jewish faith in France are pretty strong, Martin, aren't they? So it's, in a way, a kind of provocation to do a similar sort of thing to Islam as is illegal in France against Judaism.
Yes, and I think that then causes resentment and so on. But, of course, there's still no justification for murdering people that you don't agree with. These issues are going to be very tense. By and large, we've got freedom of speech to say what we like, but if you do use inflammatory language, then you have got to expect that people are going to get angry.
But one person, sort of thing that happens. I mean, some people would say there's quite a lot of inflammatory language in the Bible.
Well, indeed there is, and therefore it's, of course, and don't forget it's this idea that everybody should have freedom of speech is a relatively modern one. Throughout most of history, people have believed that you should shut up and do as you're told, and the people in charge know best.
Well, also, I mean, think from the Enlightenment, it depends what you mean by modern, doesn't it? But the whole point here, surely, is that you can say what you want so long as you're not actually inciting a criminal act. Now, that criminal act has got to be a sort of traditional criminal act, not some sort of, you know, dislike of a particular group in society. This is absolutely crucial to make this distinction. That is this an is what you're saying incitement to commit crime or not? And putting forward your religious beliefs generally is not.
No, it's not. I mean, look what happened to David Starkey when he came out with that remark about too many damn blacks. Now, he wasn't prosecuted. He was allowed to say it. But, of course, what then happened is various organisations of which he was a part said they didn't want him on their list of sponsors anymore, because they're entitled to say, well, you can say that, and we can say, well, goodbye, we don't want to talk to you anymore. So, we all know how sensitive this is all becoming. And I'm generally in favour of the more freedom of speech, the better.
Anyway.
And I think the people that say that people on the left are trying to close down freedom of speech, I'm prepared to say anything you like, as long as no crime for mummies when we start accusing you of being terrorists and murderers, which they are.
Okay,
MI6, well, for example.
Sean's taken issue this week, and he's been speaking about this down in Broadmead, about the mayor, Marvin Rees, flying flags for the transgender people. But anyway, so here he is when I spoke to him yesterday talking about this and a couple of other issues.
I've done the drugs, I've done the wealth, and I've done the poverty. I'm a man as a revelation of Jesus Christ, that every single person can also obtain. And when you obtain it, you will realise that there's nothing on this earth that can compare to the love of God.
Yeah, well, I spoke to the mayor because the mayor says that he's a Christian. So the mayor is promoting things that Christians don't believe. But I wasn't standing against that. I was saying that Christians should have a right just as well as the LBG community. We can't say that the Christian is against the LBGT. It's actually both ways. People are saying that the LBGT will not let the Christians have their flag put up. So I believe that both can have.
Where are these flags? What's going on with the flag?
Oh, it's the mayor's office. And Marvin is denying his faith. He claims to be a Christian, but typical of Marvin Rees, he can't make his mind up. I worry about him being the mayor of this city because he's very, very mixed up man. He's very unstable, so I do worry about this city and where the money is going in this city. If Marvin is a Christian, that he can't put up certain things. The flag that he put up is actually goes against his own teaching, so to put that flag up, he would have to deny his own faith.
Well, he's apparently a lay preacher up at Christ Church in Clifton.
Marvin Rees, unfortunately, is a picker and chooser of what he wants to believe. The ministry's growing. We've got teams of people coming out. We're starting to get across the cities and put a lot of conferences on. Awaken the Streets is definitely growing. The good thing about what we believe in, people's got a choice. They can walk on by, but I'm going to stand and preach the truth. We've had about 9 baptisms since I've last seen you, and we've had people. This young guy here has been raised up through our ministry of preaching. We're starting to influence America, Russia, and Europe with the gospel of Jesus Christ. what a mess the corona is. The government don't know what's going on. They don't know what they're talking about. Boris Johnson's dad's been exposed with no mask on. I don't see his father getting fined. It's double standards with this government. It's all an agenda. It's all about control. This is all heading towards a controlled system. It's heading towards a system that is going to push out the poor, and it's heading towards a system that is also pushing out the agenda of Christ, because Jesus warned that there'd be a spirit of control in the name of Jesus.
You're one of those people that holds up a big sign saying the end of the world is nigh. But what you're saying, it seems to me, is that's actually a good thing.
Yeah, no, I'm someone who reads the Bible, and I see the times coming, but my message is always to preach love and the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sean Miriam O'Sullivan on Facebook, Awaken the Streets YouTube channel. God bless you. Read your Bible.
Okay, so that's Awaken the Streets, Martin. Since I last saw Sean, he seems to have various people doing his preaching for him. You know, he's managed to convert some people, and they're the ones actually doing the talking. So he's down in Broadmead quite a lot these days. But, you know, this is an apocalyptic issue. I think most times when we've had difficulties, even, you know, during World War II, for example, there'd be people come out with these placards, wouldn't there, saying the end of the world is nigh.
Well, as you know, there are various sects in Christianity and a whole spectrum of views. So, you know, you can't really generalise. I mean, he's got obviously his views. I'm not quite clear what they all are, because we've only heard a short clip there. But there's plenty of other people with very different views who would also claim to be Christians.
What about this whole business of lesbian, gay, bi rights and Christianity? Are they two compatible?
Well, some Christians would say they're definitely compatible, and some, obviously, like him, feel that they're not. But they've, you know, he doesn't necessarily speak for all Christians. In fact, I know for a fact that he doesn't.
No, of course he doesn't. He definitely does. I can say that for sure. So it's all about interpretation, really. Anyway, I thought we'd have a look at some of the stories, more stories, national stuff this week, particularly around this whole idea of the organised crime gangs, which have apparently stolen around about $2 billion. Some other commentators have said nearer to $4 billion of furlough cash. The National Audit Office has found this. Criminals have almost certainly claimed between $1 and $1.95 billion, pocketing money intended for employees of ailing businesses. Up to $2 billion of money from the government's furlough scheme has gone straight into the hands of organised crime, Martin, apparently. Straight in. Literally, it's a similar scheme which was scammed a few years ago. They've used the same kind of basic nuts and bolts. And so, of course, those that scammed the previous scheme have scammed this one too.
Well, it's an ongoing problem, isn't it? Any system that you put in place, some people are going to try and abuse it.
So whilst for honest people, this is a loan scheme, for dishonest people, it's a gift.
Well, the problem with it being a loan scheme in the first place meant that many people didn't apply for it, and it was very difficult to get the loans. So, you know, there's issues about whether it was well designed in the first place. And of course, it was all cobbled together at the last minute without much thought.
Well, I wonder whether it was. I wonder whether there some people connected with organised crime and the Treasury have decided that this is a great scheme because some of their friends would make a load of money out of it. I mean, we know, don't we, that Goldman Sachs is a criminal organisation. It's where Ricky Sunak was. You know, he's basically a Goldman Sachs man. We had this whole thing, didn't we, of the technocrat governments around Europe over the last few years, almost all of them tracing their roots back to Goldman Sachs, and he does too.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, BlackRock in the US has probably taken over from Goldman Sachs as the vampire squid on the face of humanity, as Ellen Brown puts it. The fact is that the collapse of the banking system in 2008... that was largely due to openly criminal behaviour by the senior people in the system. And far from being punished, they were rewarded. And, of course, there's been a further, even bigger bailout now under the cover of the COVID crisis. And all the same people have made loads and loads of money on insider trading and so on. And there's no end in sight to any of this. And ultimately, of course, there's going to be a showdown about who's going to pay for the crisis. And there's going to have to be structural adjustment for the bourgeoisie, which means them losing everything. But they're not going to go quietly.
Would that be a good thing? The bourgeoisie? You're a traditional Marxist that hates the bourgeoisie.
Well, no. The thing is, if they are criminals, then they should face the full weight of the law, should they not?
I mean, surely it's mostly the middle classes are going to suffer from all this. And these people, the criminals, are going to just scoot off.
Well, what's going to happen is that the middle classes will lose their minimal savings. The poor will be really screwed and they will walk away with the money. But of course, at that point, people are going to say, well, hang on a minute, what's in this for us? I mean, they're not going to be able to provide basic security in the society for most of the population. And that's going to happen across the planet. And there's going to be a very testing time for everybody.
I would put it to you that Goldman are just as powerful as they've ever been here in the UK. Forget BlackRock. I mean, they're mainly in the US doing stuff over there.
Yeah.
The UK regulators have fined Goldman Sachs over a Malaysian fraud after 2.2 billion enforcement. The UK regulators joined others around the globe to level heavy penalties on subsidiaries of Goldman Sachs for its role in the fraud scheme, which looted billions of dollars from a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund and used the money to fund Hollywood movies, including The Wolf of Wall Street. The Financial Conduct Authority and Prudential Regulation Authority have fined Goldman Sachs International £96.6 million. It was part of a larger coordinated resolution with Goldman Sachs. Coordinated resolution? That sounds like an out-of-court settlement. Over the Malaysian Development Board, 1MDB, which cost the bank $2.9 billion. So this bank is involved in massive amounts of fraud and crime, and yet one of their little protégés is now our Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Indeed, and of course it's a charmed circle that they all move.
Isn't it amazing the way the press seem to love Rishi Sunak? They just sort of, oh, isn't he wonderful? Isn't he great? What he's doing, he's giving all this money away.
Yeah, well, I think the shine's coming off that because, of course, this week he had to backtrack and agree that he was going to provide money when he'd said he wasn't going to. And, of course, he's under pressure from the Tory backwards people saying, well, we've got to balance the books, which is why they all, or most of them, voted against extending free school meals. And at the same time, they're handing out lots of contracts to their mates for, you know, completely incompetent activity.
I don't know if you saw the press conference, I think it was Wednesday, that Boris Johnson and Rishi, or maybe Thursday, yesterday, did. He looks like a sort of mannequin. He doesn't really seem to have any personality. He just reads stuff out as if he's not a very good actor, just reading it, and he doesn't seem to have any kind of depth to his character. And that's one of the things that worries me about this guy, is it all sounds like he could be a kind of almost like an AI puppet.
Well, I mean, compared to the rank incompetence in the rest of the cabinet, he comes across as somebody who can actually string a sentence together.
I suppose that's the way the city likes to work, though, isn't it? If they can be surrounded by incompetence, including, by the way, Keir Starmer, your leader in the Labour Party, mm-hmm. it makes them look better, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think the other thing is that when he came to the Treasury, there's a very good New Statesman article about all of this. The Treasury basically recognised that there was going to be a problem with the pandemic while the rest of the cabinet was still on their holidays, etc. And they put things in place, including, you know, furlough schemes, etc., ready to go. And Rishi Sunak, although he's got quite a right-wing reputation, basically agreed to go along with what the Treasury was suggesting. And that, of course, is why he had a good crisis for the first part of the crisis. Then, of course, he started to withdraw the funding. And, of course, you can't do that, as the Japanese have discovered over 30 or 40 years. Once you start bailing the economy out, you've got to carry on bailing it out.
Okay.
So the Welsh government, we mentioned the Welsh government earlier, they just nationalised the railways in Wales because there's no option. And ultimately, of course, the government is going to have to take over virtually all of the economy. Now, that, of course, really upsets the Tories because that's not what they believe in. But
well,
I'm afraid that's what's going to happen
anyway.
They're
doing it too. Of course they're doing it.
They're going to have to because there's no alternative.
The current chairman of the BBC is David Clementi. He's a guy I don't remember ever seeing him much in public life, being some sort of sparkling character. He's a former deputy governor of the Bank of England. He then moved in on the nice little revolving door to take 22 years at investment bank Kleinwort Benson, becoming chief executive. His nickname at Kleinwort Benson, according to Wikipedia, was the Duke. And then he went on to become chairman of the BBC. He did a job incidentally for Lord Falconer of Iraq war crime fame. To undertake a wide-ranging independent review, of course the word independent has to be in there, of legal services in England and Wales, which of course are in disarray. Generally the standard of justice in Britain is, I mean, as you can see just by looking at Julian Assange's case, is hit rock bottom after this wonderful report that David Clementi did. But there is all sorts of jockeying, isn't there, for who's going to take over as chairman of the BBC. None of these people are people, public figures that any viewers or listeners would have any confidence in whatsoever, and they all seem to be very, very closely connected to the insiders of the privatised City of London.
Yeah, well, I mean, the BBC is definitely in the sights of Cummings and others in the government. They, I mean, I don't know if you've been watching the roadkill drama on BBC One. It's got a kind of Boris Johnson character. It's written by David Hare, the left-wing playwright. I watched it all over the last weekend. Very good, very perceptive, and very high quality drama. But the Tory MPs are going nuts about it because basically it's an attack on them, and they think that the BBC shouldn't be doing that.
But in the meantime,
sort of thing.
There's quite a scandalous book out on the Tories, isn't there? So whilst people might be switching off, watching their television, watching that, they're actually reading all about the inside goings-on.
The Swire book, yeah. Well, the thing is that BBC, you know, for many years it had Top Gear on with, pub bore Clarkson coming out with all of his Tory twaddle. And they didn't complain about that. But then other bits of the BBC, like the drama department, used to Play for Today and so on, back in the day, producing what you might call progressive critical drama. And the point about the BBC is there's something in it for everybody. But, of course, the Tories don't like the fact that it isn't just an echo chamber for the Tory press, which they regard as objective.
Well, Tory press have actually been serialising this Sacha Swire betraying of friends with her tell-all political memoir, Diary of an MP's Wife, Inside and Outside Power, lifts the lid on sex and shenanigans. Lady Swire sent diaries to a publisher last year after her husband retired as an MP. But local party members were absolutely disgusted at the breach of confidence. Well, actually, you can breach confidence in the public interest, and I would imagine Martin, you as a Labour member, would be quite happy with this sort of thing.
Well, I think she is obviously going to make quite a lot of money out of the book because it's got lots of juicy stuff in it, like David Cameron saying that he wanted to give her one when he said, David Cameron saying, "I've won a war this afternoon after the invasion of Libya." And so on and so forth. So there's all sorts of stuff in there.
Well, they have this thing in the Tory party, don't they? Do you remember with the young Tory that committed suicide, and then the guy who was responsible for it disappeared off immediately to the US, where they said isolate, inebriate, penetrate. That was the way of actually controlling young conservatives. So anybody that wasn't really part of the clique could be controlled and either brought into the clique or booted out, using those three words as a kind of mantra.
Yeah, and of course what the book does is it exposes lots of things which some people wouldn't like to be exposed. But there you go. I mean, that's, she presumably has lost a lot of friends by telling the stories that she's told, but she'll make plenty of money out of it.
Is she just doing it for the money, or do you think she feels a bit embittered as to what she... I mean, that's one of the senses I get, is that she was putting her trust and her faith in these people, as some party members do, you know, and then found that actually they weren't like the sort of people that she want. The way they were portrayed, they were completely different when she met them in the flesh.
Well, she's a very, very well-connected Tory wife, as it were. So you'd have to ask her what her motives were. Basically, there is a kind of pleasure, is there not, in exposing all this stuff and being the one to do it and all the rest of it. I presume that's the motive.
So just going back to the story I was mentioning about isolate, inebriate, penetrate, that was David Cameron's chum, Mark Clark, who was accused of bullying to the point of suicide. Police at that point launched a sexual harassment inquiry. That was way back in November 2015. But it's one of those things that sticks in the craw, rather, as the way that cliques operate, almost like cults, Martin. So if you're not in the clique, you know, you're out.
Well, as we know, there's an awful lot wrong with the way the world is run. and
but particularly political parties, isn't it?
Well, it's power, isn't it? That's what we're talking about.
I mean,
political parties are just the front. Behind that, you've got all of the. In the film Roadkill, it's all actually about arms sales and the military industrial complex. David Hare wrote the script. And the actual shenanigans within the party are actually more to do with all of this stuff behind the scenes most people don't think
about.
One of
the things Sasha Squire has said in this book is that Mrs. Cameron has shown herself for what she is. She has absolutely no class whatsoever. So, I mean, this is about class, isn't it? The British are kind of obsessed with that. And the idea that you're voting for people who are representing the upper middle class, and actually you find out that they don't have any class is a terrible thing for some.
Well, that's right. I mean, her husband, Hugo Swire, went to Eton along with Boris and others, and he was a Guards officer. And they genuinely think that this country belongs to them. And they don't like the wrong sort of person getting close to power. There's another play called Country by Trevor Griffiths, which is again a play for today. I watched that the other day, and that's about a country house party in 1945 as the Labour government is first elected and the reactions of the elites to the potential of losing their power and pelf. So, you know, the BBC, if you like, has, you know, in the past encouraged what you might call left-wing drama. Think about Ken Loach and so on.
Oh, it certainly did, but not anymore. It'd be great to have something like Play for Today back. It wouldn't exactly be that difficult. And actually, the BBC would regain its credibility. But it seems to me it's being deliberately sabotaged in the same sort of way as, you know, maybe British Rail was in the 1990s. You make British Rail not work, and then everyone calls for some change, and that change is, guess what? It's privatisation.
Yeah. Well, the Murdoch empire have wanted rid of the BBC for years. And ultimately, Cummings wants to cut them down to size. And we're going to see an awful lot of attempts to censor and to silence dissenting voices.
Well, the BBC have been doing that too, actually. And maybe that's part of the discrediting of the corporation. Anyway, leading all up to say, and I don't know if you knew this, Martin, but Rishi Sunak's ex-boss at Goldman Sachs is now a surprise candidate for BBC chairman. Richard Sharp, great name for someone in banking, Sharp Practice, an informal advisor on COVID-19 to the Chancellor, is understood to be applying for the £160,000 a year job. So Goldman Sachs, Rishi Sunak's, Rishi may have some say in this, mightn't he? He may be able to swing things for his old boss to take over the BBC.
Well, I don't know exactly what influence he would have on that, but they're basically creating, they want somebody to go in there and change the internal culture of the BBC, marketize it, allow Murdoch access to it. That's what they want to do, and they're going to try and do it.
I was pretty shocked by that, amazed, but then Goldman Sachs, the vampire squid controlling the world, should be well known to most of our listeners by now, and the idea that they want to take over the BBC too in order to privatise it is should hardly come as a surprise.
Well, it's not just the privatisation. They want to change the culture of the BBC, which basically allowed a diversity of voices. They want to actually delegitimise. I mean, as you said, what they've been saying in schools, that you can't use anti-capitalist teaching materials and stuff like this. I mean, I used to teach A-level economics in state schools, and I think, how can you teach A-level economics without mentioning the word capitalism? It's just ridiculous.
Or anti-capitalism, yeah. Okay, so also on the modern version of the BBC, which I suppose is the internet, Google, things like that, and control of YouTube and social media and our searches, as we're coming up to a US presidential election, Google, one of the most powerful players in this US presidential election, Martin, we know from studies that the way that Google algorithms work can actually swing a candidate 30% approval up or down, depending on whether Google decides that they want you to find good things or bad things about that candidate.
Yep. I mean, they've done studies which show that they've got very great influence, because, of course, when you put in a search term, most people only look at the first three or four, And the, you know, you've got hundreds of pages of stuff there. So
yeah, you won't find us.
Well, there you are.
I can remember for years.
This is how it works.
For years,
it?
My Bilderberg website was the first thing you put. I mean, probably for about 10, 15 years from Google in the late 90s, Google kind of popped up. And it was always the first one there. And it's slowly but surely been shunk down by, first of all, obviously by Bilderberg's own in-house website. And then also by things like Wikipedia. And now it's actually not that very easy to find at all on Google. There are other search engines I would encourage people to try using. In fact, bookmark and always use other non-Google search engines. Because Google, Martin, over the last 6 or 8 months has got, maybe a little bit longer actually, has got far, far worse. It's not actually telling you, it's not allowing you to find certain things anymore because it's decided it's blacklisting whole areas, and it's becoming an arbiter rather than an index to the internet. It's becoming an arbiter of truth and fiction. But actually what it's doing is it's presenting fiction as if it's truth and truth as if it's fiction. So it's the upside down search engine.
It is, and of course the problem with using other search engines, which of course I totally agree with, is that they simply haven't got the network capability of Google. Google, because everybody's been using it for years, they've got more stuff on there than other search engines. And other search engines struggle to keep up with the fact. So it's basically got monopoly power. And ultimately, of course, what you could do is you could, instead of privatizing the BBC, you could make Google into a public utility, but it was obliged to actually give everybody a fair crack of the whip in terms of being found.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about, which we're going to start doing in the next couple of weeks anyway, is providing a video box for people, because I remember when Channel 4 first started up, they used to do this, where people can just come and express their views and just come and talk for however long it is. If you don't have the technology, we have the technology, and put you up on brand new Tube or whichever platform it is, so that people can just express themselves, because I think we're moving into an era where certain views are just not seem to be acceptable, particularly views of certain doctors. But we're talking about privatisation there, and I would like now to have a listen to a woman called Debbie, who's we'll have a longer interview with her, a complete interview with her, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here's a clip with her. I mean, she's talking quite a lot in the longer clip about the COVID measures at her university. But here she is talking about the way that she's seen over the last few years the privatisation of our education system has affected her work as a politics lecturer.
I teach politics and I teach social science. Obviously, within a certain parameters of the modules that we're teaching, we do discuss things. Of course we do. You know, we look at the pros and the cons of different political theories. We look at the evidence for and against. But it's, as I said before, it's in a very controlled way, in the sense that the students are expected to give answers that are set in the curriculum, that are set in the textbooks. And for instance, I mean, the only thing I can do is compare it to my experience as a student, which is I'm sure what you were using as your reference point. If I look back to some of my university lecturers, they would stand there and they would, you know, of course they would look at other arguments, but they would tell you what they think about things. They would make a really strong argument to you one way or the other. They would not sit on the fence. And I thought that was so important, because I think as a student, when you're learning, you need to hear very strong but different viewpoints from different academics and different lecturers. Whereas now, because we are controlled, and that control, actually, I think the difference is that it's corporate now, Tony. When I mean, it was starting to kick in when I was a student, but now I give you an example, the department that I work in, and I work in a well-known university in the Midlands, the department that I work in, all of our courses, all the money comes from a private company. And I'm not going to say the name of the company, because it probably give away too much where I work, and I'd rather not say. But all the management is coming from this private company. And these people are managers. They are business people. They are not teachers. They are not lecturers. They're not specialists in any subjects that we teach. And they are telling us how to teach. They're designing our courses. And just to give you the latest thing that's happened that shows you how bad it is, they have now pre-designed all of our lectures for the semester. so that we just stand there like robots and deliver the lecture that's on the screen. We have no, as lecturers, we have no say in what we deliver. I mean, we can stand there and interpret it and get the students to discuss it. And of course, I will be doing that. And I'll do that to the best I can to open up critical thinking. But we still have to follow this new model that's kicking in. And it's all, to me, it's all taking us towards AI, artificial intelligence, where courses will be delivered on a screen, they'll be preset, and students will learn remotely.
So that's Debbie there. She didn't want to give her full name for obvious reasons. Martin, it's just like so many people in the NHS, etc. University lecturers afraid to give their real names now in case they get hauled over the coals of disciplinary for actually telling the truth about what's going on inside their institution now. The whole idea seems to be swamped by this concept of commercial confidentiality, also bringing a company into disrepute by being critical about it. Whereas actually, certainly I think when you and I were at university back in the 1970s and 80s, critical thinking was actually a key part of the way to learn.
Yes. And of course, the corporatization of the universities, the marketization of what's being provided. I mean, we've been, you know, our society has been moving that direction for 30 or 40 years now. And, you know, it's a very sad state of affairs, isn't it?
One of the ironies that she points out there is that the people who are telling her what to do, her line manager, have got no experience at all in those disciplines that she's teaching to these degree students.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're dumbing it down. So a degree just becomes racing through a series of preset courses that have already been written in advance. Whereas, of course, in theory, students should be investigating things with an open mind.
So, I mean, what would you do to change it? Is there anything we can do? Can this be renationalised? I'm reminded a little bit of the books by one of the Inklings. I'm not sure which one he was, about the university. I think it was actually set in Oxford. C.S. Lewis, maybe? I can't remember. But anyway, That Hideous Strength.
That's C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis, right. And that was actually about some sort of rather nasty force within the university that they were grappling with. A very entertaining book, but it seems like many of our universities are like that now, where this is, you're basically just a cog in a machine, and the idea that you're going to be encouraged to think for yourself is out the window.
Yeah, I mean, basically they are becoming corporate factories for turning out good little workers for the corporate businesses which are going to be underlying all of this. And the marketisation of universities, for example, has led to a situation where you're gradually, you know, it's no longer a separate sphere, as it were, from the commercial world in which everything else is embedded.
It's almost as if we're moving towards a world where people are not only cogs in machines, but it's almost impossible to get a job. I mean, nowadays, for example, it's becoming incredibly difficult. I was just listening to somebody on the radio the other day who she had only managed to get any work to pay the mortgage by actually having to buy a van of her own in order to work for some sort of delivery company that she couldn't get a job where she got her own van. So she had to shell out on a vehicle for herself to work for a company. Now, in the old days, of course, you know, there's no way you would have to buy a van to get a job. All of the cards seem to be in the hands of the employers and the people with the money, the bankers, and none whatsoever in the hands of ordinary people looking for a job.
Yeah, and of course, in the long run, that undermines the efficiency of the economy because people simply haven't got enough money to buy back the stuff they've produced. And then, of course, you can lend them money, but then that ultimately leads to credit bubbles, which then burst. In the 30 glorious years after the Second World War, productivity growth was similar to as good as now, usually around 3% a year in terms of increased production. And of course, wages rose steadily because trade unions were strong. And because that was the way that the economy was run at full employment to ensure that wage growth was steady and stable.
We've
got rid of all of that because ultimately capitalism doesn't work if people haven't got any money.
Hasn't the financial system just been used as a way to enslave people?
Yes, it's a way. Of course, it has. The financialisation of capitalism since 1979.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, what previously used to happen, the stock markets were a feature of the way the capitalist economy functioned, but they weren't that important. So, for example, when Vodafone took over Siemens in Germany in the 90s, I think it was, it was absolutely horrifying because they didn't have hostile takeovers in Germany at all. They still don't have them in places like Japan. But hostile takeovers have just become normal practice in the US and Britain, which is why, of course, all of our infrastructure is owned by foreign state-owned enterprises.
Well, I'm rather reminded about that book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, the US CBS journalist from World War II, that he wrote in the early 1980s, which really described Nazi tactics before they took over countries that they occupied during World War II as using banks to buy up stock in foreign banks which had stock in those industries in that country, so using banks effectively like tanks to take over.
Yeah, well, BlackRock in the US has effectively taken over both the US Treasury and the Federal Reserve. It's a private organisation, and it's not even a bank. Goldman Sachs, we're talking about them as a bank, they're a hedge fund. They made themselves a bank in 2008 so that they could be eligible for bailout funds. Now, we've now got crony capitalism on a massive scale. And ultimately, of course, there is going to be a crash and people, and that they will walk away with the loot and
so little discussion of this in Parliament? Very, very little, actually, of the real ramifications of all this and the control by the city and a tiny oligarchy of our national affairs.
Well, that's because at least one of the parties, the Tories, are funded by the city, and many of the Tory MPs worked in the city before they became MPs, like Rishi Sunak, or they're definitely intending to go back there when they've finished. So they don't criticise it. Labour MPs also, some of them have been critical, but they're just regarded as crackpots and eccentrics.
Oh, Richard Sharp, by the way, I'll tell you to miss out this little point about him. He is a Conservative donor, and the Tories are now thinking about this. Is Rishi Sunak's former boss at Goldman Sachs, is that they want to put him in charge of the BBC.
Wouldn't you have thought that somebody like, I don't know, John Pilger, maybe even Sir Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough, somebody with a sort of journalistic background? We don't need any journalists to run the TV.
The idea that you've got to have a banker running the BBC, really, I mean, that's obviously one of the reasons why the corporation's in a bit of a terrible state. And the irony is that very, very few, of course, you don't get any kind of criticism of it on Sky, because they actually want to see the BBC go down in a load of flames. Anyway, just to say, because this is all a bit depressing, let's have something a bit positive from Parliament. And somebody, if anyone was to, in the Houses of Parliament, say anything about all this stuff and dish the dirt on this lot, it would probably be my favourite MP, Zara Sultana from Coventry South. And here she is this week speaking at in quite a positive fashion to a lot of young Labour people about the nominations for the National Executive. Maybe before we hear from her, Martin, can you explain what's going on? The Labour Party is, I believe, members are voting for candidates in the National Executive.
They are, yeah. And, of course, it's it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Who are the big players in this, then? Well, is it the Corbyn Easters and the Starmerites?
It's basically the left versus the right.
That is the Corbynistas versus the
Starmerites. Well, they're not the Corbynistas anymore because these no longer.
Well, who are? What would we call them then?
We could call them the left versus the right. I mean, there's been this struggle inside the Labour Party for many.
Okay, so who's the key?
Years.
Who's the key figure on the left if Corbyn isn't?
Well, she obviously is putting a marker down for being one of those figures. But the momentum slate for the NEC, I've forgotten the list of it. But they are quite hopeful that they are going to get all of their people elected, and I think they probably will. And that then will mean that Starmer won't get his own way 100% of the time.
Well, let's hope
we shall see.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to this week's clip from Zara Sultana speaking to the Young Labour movement this week on some sort of Zoom call or something.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zara Sultana. I'm the Labour Member of Parliament for Coventry South, and it's great to be able to join you this evening. And I'm really pleased to be backing this incredible slate of candidates. A couple of years ago, it would have been me on the other side as a candidate for the Young Labour National Committee. So I'm really excited to be here today. I actually am still technically Young Labour. I turned 27 at the end of the month, so I'm just about able to vote for this incredible slate, and I'll be doing so as soon as that ballot drops, and I encourage everyone else to do the same. And we really do need a socialist future. I think that goes without saying. From the crises we face, such as inequality and poverty, to COVID-19 and climate change, they're all caused and exacerbated by capitalism. It's capitalism that puts power and wealth in the hands of a tiny minority, letting bosses exploit workers and landlords live off the labour of workers, while working people have their hopes and potentials criminally constrained. It's capitalism that puts profit before people, even as a virus rips through our society. And it's a little surprise that this Thatcherite government has used this pandemic to hand out contracts worth millions and billions of pounds to friends and donors, lining the pockets of the rich, even when that leads us to having one of the deepest recessions of any wealthy country and the highest excess death toll in Europe. And it's capitalism that's driving the climate crisis, with fossil fuel companies pumping out carbon and trashing our planet in their pursuit of private profit. And while this all happens, while living standards plummet and working people suffer, this Tory government still finds the opportunities to scapegoat minorities, to distract and divide. During the summer, one of their MPs blamed Muslims for the spike in cases. Matt Hancock has, of course, blamed young people, and we saw Preeti Patel spent weeks of this summer trying to distract us with a supposed migrant crisis. And this government is taking us down a dark and dangerous path. In the last few weeks, they have proposed the effective decriminalisation of torture for British soldiers overseas, shipping asylum seekers over 4,000 miles away to Ascension Island, banning anti-capitalist teaching materials in our schools, and of course there's the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, or Spy Cops, which would give undercover state agents a license to murder, torture, and commit sexual violence. And like I said in Parliament, I believe we have to take this descent into authoritarianism incredibly seriously. It's not just a distraction tactic. We are seeing concrete legislation being brought in on a weekly basis that grossly enhances the powers of the state and undermines our collective civil liberties. And that's why I joined comrades from the Socialist Campaign Group in voting against the Spy Cops Bill last week. This is what we're up against, a system that's unfair, unjust, irrational, callous and cruel. A government that isn't just incompetent, I think that's letting them off quite lightly, but deeply dangerous. It's our class and young people, especially being hit hardest by all of this, whether it's in the broken housing system, in the marketized higher education system, in the mental health crisis, or in precarious and low paid work. And that's why we have to be abundantly clear that tweaking the system isn't enough. Plastic straws aren't going to save us, nor are management consultants who don't have the answer. We don't just need a better version of the status quo or more competent management of the current social order. We need bold, radical answers. We need socialist answers. In this crisis, we have seen the damage of austerity and the gutting of our public services. So let's never, ever let that happen again. We've seen how privatization enriches the few and robs the rest. So let's end it and kick out Serco out of services for good. We've seen that it's not millionaire bankers that we need in a crisis. It's our nurses, our teachers, our cleaners, our shop assistants, our bus drivers and taxi drivers. It's the working class in all of our rich diversity. So let's build a society run by and for them. Of course, this isn't going to be handed down to us. It's not going to be put on a plate. We only get things by fighting for them, by organising in our communities, in our workplaces, and yes, in our Labour Party. That's why it's crucial that we get behind people who are prepared to meet the challenges we face with answers that match their scale. That's the only way we're going to get the socialist future that we deserve. So good luck to the candidates standing, and solidarity.
So that's Zara Sultana, MP for Coventry South, Martin. One of the most interesting things I think she said there was that this is not really about incompetence. It's about a kind of dangerous, malicious group of people who don't care about the vast majority of the population. They're quite prepared to commit crimes against them and, you know, effectively bully them because they've got the power to do so.
Yeah, I mean, she's taking a stronger line than you're going to hear from the Labour front bench. They are, you know, cautious by nature and also to some extent in the pocket of the establishment.
So what's the chances of, you know, some changes happening in the Labour Party with this national executive election that she's talking about there?
Well, it's hard to say because
is Starmer biting his nails?
I don't think he's biting his nails because even if the people he wants don't win, the NEC has only got very limited powers. The Labour Party has become rather. I mean, we used to, you know, there was lots of infighting, but you used to be able to know exactly how, you know, what the infighting was about and how it would be resolved. Now it's more complex because, as you know, there's various different aspects to it. It's not just a straightforward, you know, it's a bit of a Byzantine structure, basically. But I think what will likely happen is that the momentum candidates will, in fact, win because the Labour Party membership hasn't changed dramatically. Starmer was given the benefit of the doubt, which is why he won the internal election to become the leader. But I think lots of people will feel that he mustn't be given a complete blank check to take the party in any direction that he wants to go, because we want to see some changes of the kind that have just been outlined by that comrade that we've just been listening to.
Do you still use language like that, my comrade in the Labour Party?
Well, she did.
You do?
Yep.
You do. The Prince of Wales this week's visited Harrogate's Royal Air Force Menwith Hill, a.k.a. US Air Force Menwith Hill. Actually, I don't know if there's any planes ever land there. Very few. And it's mainly used for spying, isn't it, to celebrate 60 years of operations. This comes the week after his mum visited Porton Down. So some of the most dodgy organisations in our entire country to do with military operations, secretive military operations and spying on people here in the UK, as well as creating bacteriological weapons, chemical weapons down at Porton Down. The royals seem to be very fascinated by all this right now. They seem to be going to visit them, Martin.
Well, I think that it shows. I mean, this is an authoritarian security state. The regime that we now have in power is, you know, basically, as we've seen in the Assange case, a creature of the military industrial complex, and the royals are being wheeled out to cement the relations between the official part of the state and these deeper elements.
The Prince of Wales has toured the newly dedicated Serenity Park at RAF Menwith Hill in Darley. So this is just near Harrogate, near Ilkley in Yorkshire. But what's Menwith Hill used for? Because it's been a focus for protesters for over the years, for probably 30 or 40 years maybe. And certainly I can remember when I was at college up in Ilkley in Yorkshire, we could see the radomes of Menwith Hill out of the library window.
Yeah, I think is it Purvis, the woman who's been protesting against them for many, many years?
Lindis Percy,
that's right. Well, basically it's a US spy base in Britain, and it's part of the five, you know, Britain is part of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing, and of course Six Eyes, the Israelis are also included in it. And, you know, before modern techniques of spying, which are clearly, you know, on a completely different scale from what happened in the past, and they used to be able to bug up to 10,000 phones at once from up there.
Duncan Campbell exposed, didn't he, that they had a direct link into the British telecoms network and they could listen to anything they wanted to.
Yeah. And, of course, it's not, because it's American, it's a US base, they're not subject to British law. And similarly, of course, the British can spy on people in the US, and they're not subject to US law. So the way that they finessed it was, we all spy on each other's populations.
Including the Israelis.
Indeed, yes, that's right, because they've got privileged access to all of the top information.
So what's Prince Charles's...
Even though they are, in fact, a hostile power.
So what's Prince Charles's role in all this? What, is he just going around as a ceremonial thing, or does he have any actual power?
I imagine that he is involved, but only peripherally. I mean, I was just reading about the opening of a new naval base in Bahrain, which opened in 2018, and Prince Andrew and Prince Salman Khalifa opened the base, which is what your money is being spent on, dear taxpayers. Did you want to buy a naval base in Bahrain? Well, you've got one, and you're paying for it.
Well, I'm afraid you don't score too many points on that, Martin, because the Prince of Wales maintains, the Harrogate Advertiser tells us, a very close interest in the work of the intelligence agencies. In 2011, he became the royal patron of MI5, MI6 and of GCHQ, and has regular meetings with senior representatives from each agency. His Royal Highness also presents the Prince of Wales Intelligence Community Awards to honour those whose vital work could never be celebrated publicly. So he's right in there.
Yes, and of course they're quite happy to have this relationship with the Crown, because that gets away from having any accountability to the people. And so a lot of the British deep state is enmeshed with the Crown for that reason, because the Crown is more important, for example, than the government of the day. So if you have, for example, a Labour government...
It's the permanent government, isn't it?
Yeah.
The permanent
right.
government is not just the civil service, it's the Crown. And we were hearing last week about the Defence Evaluation Research Establishment privatised version of that, Kinetic, and Serco, but mainly I'm talking here about Kinetic, being privatised with the golden share. So in other words, what Lance Murdoch was pointing out was that actually this wasn't really privatised on the stock exchanges, because the actual control of Kinetic, the privatised version of what had been the Ministry of Defence research arm, a bit like DARPA in the United States, had gone to the Crown Estates and to the Crown rather than out on the open market.
Yeah, so there's various mechanisms by which the deep state protects its assets.
Well, it seems to me like Prince Charles is very much a part of this deep state.
Yes, he is. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But whether he will know whether he was tipped off about COVID coming from China by the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States, as the Israeli Defence Forces were, I don't know whether he would have been included in that.
Well, who knows? Because if you see a whole bunch of intelligence reports, somebody somewhere has got to decide, are we going to show this to Prince Charles, and someone else will decide, well, maybe we won't.
And as you well know, in intelligence circles, you show the fewer people who see anything, the better it is. So he may go around and be talking to all these people, but he won't necessarily be being told what's exactly going on. Because that's how it works, isn't it?
Well, he will most probably be taking some sort of role in appointments, I would imagine.
I would, it's a bit of a mystery to know how these things are organised, because, of course, what's actually happened is that there isn't actually a line of command. The CIA, for example, has now become hundreds of different private sector organisations who subcontract to the government. So there isn't actually not actually clear who is doing what, and lots of things going on that, but you know,
well,
the left hand doesn't know what
the
right hand is doing.
The dodgy stuff that we've dug out, I principally have dug out about M section of MI6 during World War II grabbing Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, and all the money that he had out and bringing him to the UK at the end of the Second World War. This was all also, M section was privately funded by King George VI. It wasn't part of the Ministry of Defence funding in MI6. It was a completely separate part of it, had the same role, but it was completely under the control of the monarch of the day.
Yes, and another way they get round things is by having fingers in the international drugs industry, so that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was allowing Adolfo Calera of the FLN anti-Sandinista forces access to bring in drugs into the United States, which then funded further CIA operations in Nicaragua and elsewhere. And so the idea that there's some kind of oversight of what these organisations are doing is simply wrong. They've got various mechanisms for hiding what they actually do, and they are basically in bed with the corporate criminals who run our country and other countries.
So, thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
There's a bloke next door they nicknamed Slimy Stan. His dog slipped its lead and the way down the street he ran. It was the second time today he broke the lockdown ban. So I called the local bobby to put him in the can. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. He's been a naughty boy, I think you might agree. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I walked to the shops for essential food to eat. I shuffled in the queue from 2 to 3:15. When I got back home I'd forgotten to buy the meat. So I had to go out for another walk down the street. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I've been a naughty boy, I think you might agree. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. Then his dog ran away, we chased it onto the beach. When I went for his collar it was slightly out of reach. A bobby came along and recited us the speech. You're meant to stay indoors of the order, you're in breach. Stay home, never more to roam. Stay home, never more to roam. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. We've been naughty boys, I think you might agree. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. We've been naughty boys, I think you might agree. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. Stay home, stay home. Never more to roam.
Okay, so not sure of the who it was that did that, but if you want to find it online, I'll put a link up to it on our show page as well. It's I Snitched on Me Neighbour from a few months ago, but another one of those COVID songs. I'm going to try and play something. Actually, you know what? I think I might play another one a little bit later on. I've got one by someone called Starmsy, which is obviously some sort of Mickey take of Keir Starmer, called Bossy Cop, and that's a way of kind of having a bit of a go at Keir Starmer. So we'll have that, I think, before the end of the show. But this week, welcome back. The coming storm, as mentioned by LLMC Lance Murdoch last week. What is going to happen? The Great Reset won't be possible without a fair amount of disruption. A shock doctrine therapy for the masses. With Britain's exit from the single market at the end of December, will that be an inflection point where democracy clashes with the oligarchy, with a collapse in the nation's finances and possibly world finance too? Are we going to see disruption and collapse in our utilities, gas, water, electricity, a collapse of communications and travel, this sort of thing? Fuel running out? Will we see new kinds of impersonal policing to keep the population scared and indoors? Is the disruptions big enough to the food chain? Will some have to forage in the countryside for food? Wishing no, not so many badgers have been culled now, maybe, eh? And foreign policy, is it ruled out of the final presidential debate? It was ruled out last night in the United States yesterday. Surely that means war is coming. They don't want to make any commitments this time. Or is it there just to help Trump? so he can hide his support for a coming Israeli war on Iran. Also, we'll be looking at the links between Aleister Crowley and the Zionists, explained by Doc Joyner, extraordinaire, David Livingston, as he talks to me about his new book, Ordo Ab Kao, which is the little motto for all Scottish Rite Freemasons, which Albert Pike was one of the most famous ones, one of the first ones, the master in the United States during the American Civil War. And the evil killer of P.C. Yvonne Fletcher, or one of the greatest African statesmen of all time, bayoneted up the backside by a NATO-supported mob. The late, great Colonel Gaddafi talks about the U.S. assassins over the last 50 years. And you've heard about the Bay of Pigs and bringing in the greenback dollar? Well, Gaddafi suggests another reason why JFK may have been assassinated. But Martin, let's start with the presidential debate last night. I was absolutely gobsmacked, as I think I was saying last week or the week before, that we were going to keep a very, very close eye on what was said about foreign policy. But apparently no foreign policy was allowed to be discussed in the presidential debate. So that means that 90%, 90, 95, 99% of the world's population got absolutely nothing from that debate. Everyone is watching to see what is going to be Trump's policy, foreign policy, in the run-up to this presidential election. Obviously, he's anti-Iran. He's pro-Israel in every single way, anti-China, etc. But is he going to make any commitments not to start new wars? I mean, that was the commitment he made back in 2015, but he doesn't seem to want to talk about it this time.
Well, as you say, nobody was supposed to talk about it. And, of course, that's because, in actual fact, there's a wide consensus amongst the elite in the US about what they want to do. The main argument is whether we go to war with China first or Russia first. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians are listening.
Iran is in.
The Israelis
are a lot
the
easier. They're a smaller country. They haven't got as many nuclear weapons, and they're not likely to hit back.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, we can see that there is actually very dangerous circumstances emerging all over the world. In the Caucasus, in the South China Sea, off Taiwan, in the Gulf, the potential for some spark to set off a conflagration in Syria, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Libya. I'm afraid there's all sorts of possibilities where it could start.
One thing I would like to do, though, is have a listen to going back to the almost uncovered by the mainstream press meeting of the United Nations General Assembly this year. One of the most interesting contributions, for me anyway, was one of the Gulf states, Martin. Can you guess which one? If you could hear from any one of them, which one would it be? You think you might get a bit of sense from?
Oman?
Qatar. Ah. And so here's the Emir of Qatar. Obviously, it's not actually the Emir speaking, it's a translation. But this is what he had to say. It's only a quite short clip at the United Nations a few weeks ago, because there is a sort of split, isn't there, developing within the Gulf states. Many of them, one by one, are coming out openly as supporting Israel, even though they're Arab countries, against the Palestinians.
Yes, and Qatar, of course, is also aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood and with Turkey. There's a Turkish military base there. And they've also got a less hostile attitude towards Iran because they've got a shared gas field which they can exploit between them. And, of course, the sanctions were placed on Qatar by Saudi Arabia. So, yes, all is not sweetness and light amongst the Gulf states.
No, and this is what they call hardening the sides, isn't it, before a conflict. Each of those various Gulf states, so-called Arab states, seem to be making absolutely clear which side they're on before an actual war starts.
Yeah, and, of course, the alliance between Bahrain and the UAE and the Israelis has been going on for a very long time. But of course, in Bahrain in particular, the population doesn't support they don't want a British naval base. I mentioned the British naval base in Bahrain. The sheer majority in Bahrain do not want that naval base there.
obviously we know that there's potential for an economic crash. There's also potential for a military crash. What do you think is the likelihood in the next Trump administration or Biden administration, whoever wins, that some kind of war will break out? Because, you know, we've been talking about this for a long time, and it does seem as if it seems to me certainly as if it's edging closer and closer, particularly with the assassination of General Soleimani, the Iranian general in Iraq earlier this year.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that stopped it from turning into a major war was the restraint shown by the Iranian side, and then the restraint shown by the US side, which was that they realised if they responded to the Iranian missile attacks on their bases in Iraq, that then they would basically lose a huge amount of
casualties. Well, the trouble with all of this is that Donald Trump is known for his art of the deal book, isn't it? So this starts to look a little bit dangerous when it's coming to potential nuclear war.
Yes, and I think...
it's brinkmanship, basically. That's what he's made his reputation on.
Yes, and of course we've seen that the North Koreans have now developed these intercontinental ballistic missiles which can hit the United States, and they've got nuclear weapons. So, I mean, from their point of view, that's the necessary thing they have to do.
Is that justified, do you think?
Well, if they didn't have nuclear weapons, the Americans would potentially nuke them or invade them. So you could argue that from their point of view, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
So it makes perfect sense as well, then, in that argument for the Iranians to have nuclear weapons.
No, because the Iranians have got better alliances. The Russian army could actually end up on the Gulf coast very, very quickly if the Iranians wanted to let them through.
Anyway, let's get round to listening to what the Emir of Qatar had to say a few weeks ago at the United Nations General Assembly. And I thoroughly recommended people to go onto the UN YouTube channel and have a listen around the world to some really interesting leaders there. People like Imran Khan in Pakistan have got all sorts of interesting stuff to say. And I'm afraid our own leaders don't fare very well. They're kind of robotic speeches in comparison. But anyway, here's the Emir of Qatar now.
Failure to find a just solution to the Palestinian cause, Israel's continued settlements and forcing a new reality on the ground without being deterred, this is what raises the biggest question about the credibility of the international community and its institutions. We call upon the international community, especially the Security Council, to assume its legal responsibilities and compel Israel to lift the siege on Gaza Strip, to put the peace process back on track through credible negotiations based on international resolutions and not on force. Negotiations must address all final status issues. They must end the occupation within a specific time frame. They must lead to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state within the 1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital.
So that's the translator giving us the words of the Emir of Qatar at the UN. Absolutely adamant, Martin, apparently, that the Palestinians must have their rights. Interesting still to hear that some countries, including China, by the way, are saying that the East Jerusalem must be the Palestinian capital.
Yes, I mean, that's been the position of the international community for many years.
But it isn't, is it?
Well, it's not the position of the United States.
But it's not the position of the Israelis who occupy it.
No, but they're the ones that the rest of the international community has always made it clear that the solution should be. But of course they've ignored that, and the US has ignored it, and Britain colludes in ignoring it as well.
Okay, well, with looking at this US presidential race still, Twitter has removed a post by the White House COVID advisor regarding masks. So this is a story in various outlets, but in the Epoch Times is the one I found. I just find it extraordinary that a White House advisor is having their information not only not reported by the mainstream press in the US, but Twitter saying, oh, you can't say that.
Well, Twitter is a private organisation, isn't it? And they've got an agenda, just like any other private organisations.
Is Dr. Scott Atlas, do they have a doctor running Twitter that thinks that he's... Anyway, what Twitter has said is they're accusing him of violating its policy about misleading information. So Twitter is becoming like the Ministry of Truth over in the US, isn't it? And this is rather worrying in the run-up to an election.
Well, I mean, the big tech companies in the US are pretty clearly aligned with the Democrats. And that, of course, means that they're not quite hostile to Trump and his minions, but also it means that they're hostile to Bernie Sanders and what passes for the left in the United States. So the problem is, as we were saying about Google earlier, these are essentially monopoly organizations, and therefore they should either be broken up into lots of smaller organizations so that you can get different political views from different organizations, or you have to nationalize them and then ensure that they allow genuinely equal access to different points of view.
So what was it that he was saying that Twitter said was not allowed to be said? Misleading information. So this is a little bit like we were hearing about British universities. There is a sort of their orthodoxy that is the only thing you're allowed to say. And if you question it or put forward different evidence, you're told to shut up or banned or whatever. You have your tweets deleted. What he said was this. He said, masks work? No. LA, Miami, Hawaii, Alabama, France, Philippines, UK, Spain and Israel and the World Health Organization, quote, widespread use of masks is not supported and create many harms. And then he quotes Hennigan and Oxford CEBM, despite decades of considerable uncertainty about their value. The CDC, he's also quoting, saying no signal red in influenza transmission, and learn why. He puts a link in there. So that's the posts that they were deleting. But he's basically putting forward an argument against masks, backed up by facts. And he's being told you're not allowed to say that by Twitter.
Yeah, well, Twitter can, you know, it's like the Daily Mail. They can say anything they like about Corbyn. Should they be closed down? Should they be made to have give Corbyn a fair platform? Twitter is basically a corporation. They're aligned with the Democrats, as we know. And of course, the president himself has used Twitter on many occasions to get his point across. So he's certainly been one of their biggest customers. And but you could argue that they shouldn't basically control what's said on their platform. But the fact of the matter is, there's no law that says that they can't.
No, but the interesting thing about propaganda is once people see it for what it is, then the platform loses, people lose trust in the platform.
That's possible.
Whether it's the BBC Twitter, whoever.
Yes,
it is,
but at the same time they do it because in the short run it has the effect of suppressing views that they don't like. And in actual fact, most people will be unaware that it's ever taken place.
You're absolutely right, because they won't be talking about this on the mainstream press. Another thing in the presidential race, probably the biggest actually over this last week or even couple of weeks, Giuliani claims Hunter Biden's laptop contained numerous pictures of underage girls. He says there's explicit material was given to the police. And also, Trump is to bring Hunter Biden's business partner, who confirmed the leaked emails are real, as a guest in last night's debate. So this is the big hot thing that apparently some news outlets are not allowed to talk about. The New York Post doesn't think so. It's talking about it quite a lot. But this is an alleged laptop which was taken in for servicing by Hunter Biden, and then he forgot about it. And the hard drive is now seems to be circulating around newsrooms in the United States.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically the, you know, people are digging the dirt on their political opponents and attempting to use it to throw it around and create as much mess as they can. And that's politics in the United States.
But it's journalism. It's journalism, actually, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. But of course,
if you've got a hard drive, I mean, maybe we can relate this a bit to the hard drive which was stolen from the Houses of Parliament with the MP's expenses on.
Yeah.
Because this sort of information can be, you know, it could be true information, but it can be used in quite a clever way. In other words, it may be that this has been hanging around for a while and that they've just chosen to bring it out 2 weeks before the presidential election.
I think that's pretty much a slam dunk, Tony. They could have brought it out at any time because they've had access to it for a long time, but they leave it till the last minute because they want it to have as much impact on the election as they possibly can make it have. I mean, it's pretty well known that Hunter Biden is a dodgy character in all sorts of different ways. But and then so is Jared Kushner, who is Trump's son-in-law. They're basically... What's fascinating to an outsider about this is how corrupt they all are. And at times like this, they start throwing mud at each other. And so we get to look at all of them and how much mud and how dirty they all actually are. And of course, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. The real corruption probably we don't, you know, is still being hidden despite all the things that are in plain view.
Okay, well, we're going to be looking in a minute at the so-called leak, the Pirbright document, which is looking at the whole coronavirus pandemic as a psychological operation and explaining, you know, the various different parts of it. But before that, let's take a little look at some of the reasons why we should be concerned. And this is a clip from a YouTube channel of a chap called Alan Yearly. And he's saying, why is this all happening now? The UK legislation has been changed, allowing forced detention and forced treatment, murder, rape and spying on the population. So let's have a listen to Alan Yearly now. This is from his YouTube channel.
So this year, they've written laws that say they can take us from our homes even if they cannot prove that we have a disease or an infectious disease, just that they reasonably believe we have. They've said that they can pump us full of stuff. And by the way, if we're dead, we're not going to get checked properly. Whatever they say we died of, someone's probably going to sign it off without even looking at us and being there. And then we can get chucked into an incinerator. If they come round and you don't want to maybe take your vaccine, well, you must be mad. Why would you want the saviour? Why would you not want the thing that's going to create, you know, you to be able to go back to your new normal? Right? You must be insane. You must be mad. You don't want your kids to be safe either. Mad as well. It keeps happening, all the stuff that I'm concerned about, day by day, bit by bit, piece by piece, lockdown by lockdown, and legislation by legislation. Because we've been told about this several times, guys. You can go and do your research. Go and look up your Agenda 21, your Agenda 2030, okay, your events. So, yeah, call it a conspiracy theory stuff if you like. This is people with lots of money, lots of organisational power, military might. They own the World Banks, guys. They own everything. It's big corporations. This is organised crime on a mass scale. And if you go and have a look at it, it's all there for you to see. Okay, I'm shouting about it. Thousands, I mean hundreds of thousands of other people are as well. If you guys don't want to bother to go and look at some of the stuff I'm talking about and you can't figure out a way of getting through your cognitive dissonance, you can't figure out how to get on with, have a look around. Other people haven't been. But they're cut off, they're censored. If you go and look for them, they're there. You can find out most amazing amounts of information, but you've got to go and do it. All right, now, this weekend, another big one. Everyone get out in London. Everyone get out every weekend. Wherever you live, speak to your friends, speak to your family, start talking about this on the school gate, and I love you loads.
So that's Alan Yearly speaking earlier this week on his YouTube channel, a little piece he's done called Why Now. He feels like everything seems to be coming together, but he's pointing the finger quite absolutely directly at organised crime, Martin. He's saying that actually they're making an absolute fortune out of this, the organised criminals, and they're also changing the laws in the country in order to formalise their control over us.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I don't dispute that the response to the COVID-19 epidemic has been a psychological warfare operation, but I don't think it's one that's been but that doesn't mean that there isn't a danger from COVID-19. It's a biological warfare attack with a psychological warfare operation tacked onto it. And of course, they've bailed the banks out as a result of using COVID as the cover. And that's, they wouldn't have been able to do that otherwise because the banks were falling down anyway. And if they'd had to just bail them out and say, we've got to bail them out again, there would have been an outcry. But because of COVID, they can just do it. And of course, they're also setting in place a panopticon of surveillance of the population because there's going to be, we're basically going to war. That's what's happening.
I would dispute this whole thing about how dangerous this virus is right now. It looks to me as if it's much less dangerous. And one of the reasons I say that is because of the, great deals of fraud going on within the test system, COVID testing system. So, I mean, almost every week we're getting more and more evidence of this coming out. And it doesn't help, does it, Martin, when we know that the private businesses doing this. We had a thing last week about the Milton Keynes office where it was quite clear that the basic practices for labs were not being followed. People with no qualifications were being employed and given no training in order to do these tests. They were contaminating each other, possibly, in the building with the things that they were supposed to be testing for, and the basic procedures were not being followed. And So let's have a listen now. I mean, Serco take a great role in this test and trace thing as well. And we don't have much confidence in Serco. They're not a company that anybody can trust other than it's run by Rupert Soames. And we'll be hearing from him, who's a Tory donor, brother of Nicholas Soames and a grandson of Sir Winston Churchill. So they're obviously part of the Tory establishment. Who are deciding whether or not people are allowed to have be on quarantine or not. So it's hardly surprising, Martin, is it, that people don't have a lot of confidence in this test and trace system and the various things that have been put in place, because they're all privatised.
Yes, and I think whatever your views on COVID, the venality of the giving of contracts to cronies and their incompetence to carry out the basic function that they've
But it's not incompetence, employed. It's more than that. We know in the past these Serco has been fined for fraud time yes. and time again.
Yes. So the very least you could say is they shouldn't have been given these contracts. And I think there's wide consensus about that from all reasonable-minded people. But I'm sure you will find that plenty of Tory MPs are quite happy to carry on supporting what they do because they're part of the clique.
And we'll be hearing a bit more about political corruption, actually from first-hand knowledge of the Welsh Parliament a little bit later on. But for now, let's have a listen to Talk Radio earlier on this week, where Ben from Bristol phoned up to talk about what he saw as more COVID test fraud.
A simple story. Some friend of mine just told me today, texted me today, that two people that she knew went for a test in Wrexham. Car park was full, so they turned back and thought, we'll go another day. And guess what came through the post 2 days later? Can you guess, Mike? Can you guess what the result was?
Was it positive?
Two positives, yeah. That's your first point. Second point, listen to BBC yesterday. They said only 300 people a year now are dying of flu. What planet is this? Normally get up to 10 to 20,000. Isn't it obvious there's something not right with these figures? And that a lot of the COVID figures, we can't even believe the death stats anymore. Where have all the flu deaths gone? You understand why there's conspiracy, Mike. Third point, 110 people the average last week. I thought about that in a population of 70 million. That calculates, yeah, this is how I can set it out. Seven Live Aid Wembley 1985 stadiums full of people with one person dead for all seven of those concerts.
Really?
That's what we're in hysteria on at the moment. And final point, are we looking at Europe, looking at the stats? We were told a few weeks ago Spain was the next apocalypse. I've looked at the stats there, and by the way, they've got the strictest masking there. Mm. The deaths there have plateaued, not much higher than ours, yeah. just about 150 for about the last 10 days.
Right.
But that's not on the TV, is it, or the media? I thank God for what you're doing on your show, because we've got to turn this thing over, Mike.
We do. We really do, because we can't have the entire country going to rack and ruin, people killing themselves, people going into destitution, losing their businesses that they've had for decades, just because of these damn politicians who don't seem to know their elbow from another part of their anatomy.
And the only guy who we can trust, the guy stood next to Boris, he's what, got a £600,000 share in a vaccine company?
Yeah.
And he's the guy scanning out the grass, and that's not shadows and mirrors, that's fact, that's in the public domain.
Oh, I know.
How can we trust anybody or anything? We need to get back to normal ASAP, otherwise we're all going to move to Sweden, Mike.
Ben, you're a very brave man, and you're absolutely right to say all of those things. Ben in Bristol, talking absolute sense here on Talk Radio, because of course we are the home of common sense. Let me talk to Nigel now, whose photographer has been out with the cops last night in the West End, looking around to see what's going on. Nigel, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm glad to say I'm going to have to rename this country, not from Great Britain, to Bonkers Britain, I'm afraid to say.
Yes.
The country's gone mad. Well, last night, Mike, in the West End, it was a very sad, sorry state. I walked around Oxford Street, Regent Street, Piccadilly, Soho, Leicester Square. The place was, apart from a few people, was desolate. And it's a great pity that our city is dying on its knees. And I'm sorry.
So that was Ben from Bristol and someone else on Talk Radio earlier this week speaking, Martin, about fraud. I mean, this is there's actually quite a lot now. People are trying these things out, sending in maybe a little bit of orange juice or something that they put on the test to see if it comes back positive or not. And there is an enormous great incentive on the testing companies in order to find more and more and more COVID. The idea, what he talked about there was he's talking about it as hysteria. It's certainly an obsession, and you could also say it's a kind of almost like psychotic kind of hypochondria.
Well, you could say all of those things, and they may or may not be true. The fact is, as you pointed out, that not very many people in Soho, that tends to suggest that quite a lot of people have taken it seriously, even if some people haven't.
Well, that's not what he's saying, really. Is he's saying it's not whether the people are taking it seriously or not. It's about whether these measures are justified. I mean, it's the first time that this has ever happened in London, apart from the plague. And this kind of thing is nowhere near as deadly as the plague. It's killing very, very few people in comparison. And some would say now almost nobody.
Yes, some would say, Tony.
A case-demic is being called.
A case-demic.
Can you listen.
We're not going to necessarily agree about these things. There's no reason why we should. People have got their views. If they've got evidence that things have been fraudulent, then they should bring it forward.
You've just heard some there. Anyway, well, let's have a look at Serco particularly, because it was great to see Rupert Soames, and I almost feel like I should call him Sir Rupert Soames, but actually, no, he's not a sir, on Peston. He's the boss of Serco, Martin, this enormous, great company. And what we hear is a good bit of work on the Peston programme is actually trying to dig out just how powerful this octopus business is that Lance Murdoch referred to last week as the serpent company, Serco.
Hello and welcome. Coming up, why is Test and Trace not reaching as many potentially infected people as it should? Serco's boss, Rupert Soames, should know. Now, you're about to speak to Rupert Soames, and we all know that Serco do a lot of work for government. So I wanted to find out how much public money is spent on them overall. But I have to say, it proved a little bit difficult. I went to a government press officer who said they didn't collate that information. They sent me to this website, which I actually struggled with a bit, but you can put Serco in. Eventually, we found 114 contracts over the years. You could go through those one by one, but I thought maybe we could go to Serco, see what they had to say. And they did give us information on what they did all around the world with examples, managing prisons, providing housing for asylum seekers, managing the atomic weapons establishment. I was interested in that one. But again, they didn't give us an overall headline figure. Now, the focus right now has been on Serco's involvement in contact tracing. There are two types of contact tracing, complex contacts and non-complex. Complex ones might be, say, for example, where there is a case in a school or a factory or a prison where you could get cluster outbreaks. Now, in those complex cases, it is the local authority that gets involved to do the contact tracing. And as you can see from the success here, they do very well. Nearly 100% of contacts are traced in that way. Now, Serco is involved in this other bit, non-complex contacts. That's more like you or I get COVID, they ring us up and they try to trace who we've been close to. That is the vast majority of contact tracing. Now, in success terms, the figure is way lower. It's at 57%. Hence, there has been criticism of Serco. They do fall well short of the 80% threshold, which is the target. Robert.
Thanks, Anusha. So, tons to pick up there with Rupert Soames, Chief Executive of Serco. So, what is your annual revenue from the government?
Well, we do about £3.5, £3.6 billion worldwide,
yep.
Of which about 40% is with the UK government.
So what, that's so about £1.5 billion,
and it's all we got. That's all we do. We support governments around the world. That is no secret, and if you wanted to ring us up and ask us how much,
there just, can we go and ask
it's in our annual report. Our test and trace system in the UK now is the largest by a country mile in Europe. We're doing 1.2 million tests a week, generating 220,000 contacts a week. So it's huge. We run the call centres who are not doing the tracing, but are doing the following up of the contacts who the tracers have identified.
Yep.
And of the ones where we get the correct telephone number, we reach 90%. I am not an epidemiologist, but what we do know is that we have now got the largest test and trace system in Europe by a country mile. We are testing 60% more people than the Germans, 40% more than the French, over double what the Spanish and Italians are doing, and it is creating huge amounts. And even if we're, Robert, even if we're not getting to the 80%, which I would argue we probably are, the 690,000 people who've been contacted and asked to isolate, I think we we have to have a national effort to persuade people to comply, to respond to the traces, and then when they're asked to isolate, to do so. But this is a huge part of our battle against COVID. And if we have people trivialising that, if we have...
What do you mean by trivialising?
I mean trying to turn it into a... Rosanna, God bless her, has been tweeting out saying, Serco, test and trace, referring to how do you think the 40,000 people who are running the biggest testing system in Western Europe, delivering 1.2 million tests a week, feel, seeing on Twitter that they're being referred to as Serco, test and trace?
But this is your problem, is it? Because it just means that your, you know, the reputation of your company is not what it should be.
It's not the reputation of the company, it's the reputation of test and trace. To try and deny that this is run by the NHS, designed by the NHS, quite properly the tracers are NHS and local authority can I tell you why this is so dangerous? We have precedent here. We have precedent of people going and changing facts and actually telling mistruths about major medical things. It's called anti-vaxxers. And the anti-vaxxers persuaded people not to go and get vaccinations. And if we have a Labour Party that is putting out announcements, as they did today, saying the system is collapsing when we're doing 1.2. So you're phoned up by somebody and said, I'm from NHS Test and Trace, will you isolate? And they're told that it's a collapsing system, nobody gives a damn, and by the way, it's run by a greedy capitalist whose incompetence is only matched by the size of his girth.
Rosanna, I think you probably want to come back on that, don't you?
Yes, you've actually... made huge profits of £165 million last year. You have had contracts in excess of £500 million. How much of that is, you know, lining the pockets of shareholders rather than actually delivering the job that you were set out to do? And fundamentally, we have been calling, as a Labour Party, we have been calling for the test, track and trace system to be in the hands of local communities and public health authorities who know their communities best. And they are delivering a contact tracing rate of 97.1. Serco is only delivering a contact tracing rate of 68.1. And Sage has said that we need an 80% contract tracing rate in order to be successful.
I have put this to Rupert. Rupert, what do you have to say?
Because... it's using fake data, and even because the contract tracing rate, as I said, is much higher.
And finally, because I think this is a material point, it does upset people that in a time of national crisis, your company seems to be making really a significant amount of money out of this. You pushed up your profit forecast for the year by 20 million.
Yeah.
Some would say, to a large extent, on the back of this work. You must understand why people feel uncomfortable about
it. We only deal with governments around the world, first of all, is that over half of our work is overseas. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, for every... £96 of cost that we, of effort we do to the government, there is 4%. £4 goes so-called to shareholders. I can't help it. And the private sector has helped build the Nightingale Hospitals, helped supply 30,000 ventilators. We have 25,000 people in the UK who have stood firm running hospitals, running healthcare, and be told that this is all appalling stuff, that these people are not worthy of delivering
I haven't had a chance.
Very good to see you. Thank you so much for coming in. Come back soon.
So that sort of descended into chaos.
With profits on the back of a system that is failing. It is failing.
Our economy alive.
And that's one of the crazy things about the Peston programme is people just completely talk over each other. And whilst the MPs are discussing something, there'll be someone swapped around and Rupert Soames is kind of rotated out on a kind of little chair and someone else appears. But it is live. Martin, you know, that we have to really put the other side, don't we? There's Rupert Soames putting his case there. He's saying that they're getting lots of wrong phone numbers, which is why they haven't been managing to do the contact tracing so successfully.
Yeah, well, I understand that that's one of the problems, isn't it? I mean, it's all very well when you've identified who you think are the people that are the carriers, but if they then just ignore or they give the wrong phone number or whatever, you're in a difficult situation. And of course, there is a basic question is why is this being done by the private sector? I mean, the obvious place to do these kind of things, it would be using GP surgeries and existing medical facilities.
He's saying, is the NHS doing this?
No, but of course he's wrong, isn't he? The NHS, if they were doing it, wouldn't be doing it for a profit, would they? They may or may not be efficient, but they wouldn't be doing it for a profit. And of course, as you can see in countries where they have had more successful COVID war, if we want to call it that, they haven't been subcontracting it out. Serco basically have no background in medical emergencies.
I mean, one of the most fascinating things about that was the little report at the very start, as they often, they're very good on the Peston programme, the best part of it in some ways, where he's given she is given the runaround, first of all by the government and then by Serco, as to how much they've actually got in contracts. And he finally actually fesses up there on the programme to say they've got around about £1.5 billion worth of UK government contracts. But this is some of the most important work that the British government is doing. Serco are actually managing every bit of it.
Well, you've got Carillion and Capita as well. And of course, they went bankrupt, which absolutely causes huge problems why are you subcontracting this stuff to the private sector
anyway?
What
about the atomic weapons establishment? I mean, we know that these are a fraudulent company. What are they doing in there?
Well, basically, the point is that you create what you're doing is you're collecting taxes from the population in general in order to achieve various goals, you know, having a nuclear deterrent, whatever, and you make sure that your insiders get those contracts. And then, of course, these private companies, a bit like Twitter, they can then fund the Conservative Party so that they can win elections and get more contracts.
Rupert Soames is not really interested in having, it seems from that clip anyway, a discussion about vaccines and how safe they are. Now, this is an important public health debate, but he's already decided that it's not allowed to happen.
That was him basically trying to evade the questions that he was being asked, because there's nothing to do with vaccines, is it? We're talking about test and trace. So he's saying, you've got all these people out there who are against vaccines, which is true, but it's nothing to do with
saying this for the Bill Gates of this world, saying, look, guys, I'm on your side?
He's basically trying to muddy the waters. Discussing about whether they are competent to carry out a test and trace operation is nothing to do with people's views about vaccines one way or the other, is it? It's a totally separate question.
Well, it should be. so let's have a look now at this Purbright 21 document. Now, this is looking, Martin, at the possibility of this being a psychological operation. I mean, before we start, you seem to veer towards that COVID is something somehow involved in some sort of psyop. But how would you paint it if it is?
It's clearly a psychological warfare operation. I don't have any dispute with that at all. But it's also based upon an actual biological warfare attack, in my view, which is designed to mess up the Chinese economy just as they were becoming the dominant economy on the planet. But of course, because they've managed to deal with the crisis internally much more successfully than the Western deep state anticipated, it's actually turned into a bit of a mess up. And as anybody who's been involved in any military operation will tell you, anything that can go wrong will go
wrong. Okay, so let's let you put your critical eye over this Purbright 21 document. And there's 12 points in it. And if I just go through them one by one, just give us a brief.
Who are they? Explain who it is.
It's a leak. A leak of some sort. Okay. So point one is our false flag chemical weapons attacks in Syria have failed. The Anglo-Zionist Empire has been blocked militarily by Russia. Brexit was also a hammer blow to the Empire's plans for a United States of Europe, to domestic populations, and they must now be reined in.
Now, is this an internal document or is it somebody's idea of what they think is happening? I mean, that doesn't sound like it's a document that's been leaked, Tony. That's somebody's analysis.
Okay, well, what do you make of what's said there anyway?
Well, but there's clearly a psychological warfare operation going on around COVID. It was designed, that's their view. My view is it was designed to sabotage the Chinese economy. This is what Engdahl was saying. We talked about William Engdahl last week. But, of course, the Chinese basically realised what was going on quickly, and they've managed basically to contain the crisis quite effectively within their own borders. But, of course, it was allowed to flow back over that, you know, the mainstream politicians wouldn't necessarily be told about this. They're allowed to let the COVID spread so that they can then bring in all of the measures that people are unhappy about.
So the idea really, look, long and short of point number one is about domestic populations being reined in.
Yes, it's the purpose of all of this, like the 9/11 attacks. The 9/11 attacks were carried out from inside the US security forces for two reasons. To get the population within the US terrified and then to, and under control. So the Patriot Act was then zoomed through. It's obviously been sitting on the statute, you know, waiting to go for years. And then they invaded various countries that otherwise we wouldn't have invaded.
Okay. So
it's got two goals.
Point number two, power grab, using mass media to control bounds of public debate, bury all expert criticism for the deep state and intelligence services corporatocracy, now firmly in charge of government institution and progress of all policy initiatives, gaining more traction over decisions about their own budgets.
Yeah, so the purpose of all of this is to create a crisis, and it's not to say that there isn't a crisis, there is a crisis, then they use the crisis. It's all in Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. This is what they do, they're disaster capitalists. And I think that some people knew what was going to happen before any of it happened. So as we know, the Times of Israel basically told us that the Israeli Defense Forces were told there was a pandemic coming out of China in November. Now that means some people are in the know. It's basically a biological warfare agent. It's been modified. It's not something that's come from nature. And it may well be that the DARPA were invested in the Wuhan laboratory. So in other words, they're carrying out research with the Chinese on extending viruses. And that gives them a perfect opportunity to seed the virus inside China.
It's interesting, isn't it? One of the expressions I like about this is that the deep state is gaining much more traction over the decisions made about their own budgets.
Yeah, I mean, there are winners and there are losers in all of this. Just as somebody bet stock options on the airlines involved in 9/11 and made a lot of money out of it, but that led back to Buzzy Krongard, former executive director of the CIA. So if you're an insider in these deep state games, you can position yourself to make loads of money, which then allows you to invest in further, not to put too fine a point on it, fuckery, because we're actually we're not under Ofcom rules.
Psychological warfare training and operations persuading the masses of the populations to set off on a path of increasing slavery, to give up their liberties without a fight. Staggering big lies are the best to do this. Barely comprehensible audacity with the prime objective of dividing and ruling. The plucky fight-back leaders would be branded outcasts.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is somebody's opinion, Tony. It's not really it's not really an internal document, is it? It's somebody's opinion about what they think.
I don't know what it is. I just find it fascinating. Point four, discrediting of elected governments through infiltration and sabotage, impoverishment and destruction of small, medium enterprises, and a giant wealth boost for the tech giants. Well, we've certainly seen that.
Yes. And of course, this is all consistent with an attempt to take down the Chinese economy and to re-establish the United States as the dominant power with full-spectrum dominance.
Enormous changes, point five, in behaviour, an exercise in what the public will accept and a way to identify businesses and individuals who may lead resistance to corporate change so they can be attacked through the legal system, etc., and otherwise disabled from action and impoverished at a later date.
Yeah, I mean, all of this is, you know, it's like, yes, of course, it's a psychological warfare operation, but it's also a warfare operation. Yeah, you've got to start off by trying to seeding it.
Point six is very much more about the psychological side of it. The use of the World Health Organization public relations term "Build Back Better," both by Joe Biden and Boris Johnson and other world leaders. They're actually following a World Health Organization PR strategy, not their own.
Well, the US has left the World Health Organization because they claimed it was too easy on the Chinese. The Chinese basically regard that as an error by the US.
I mean, they use this word "build back better," but they don't really seem to be building back at all at the moment.
Well, if you think about it, "build back better" is chosen because it's got three B's in it and it's alliterative. It's about as useful as a real analysis of what's going on as
Well, you need to tell that to the World Health Organization.
Well,
anyway.
No, the World Health Organization, I very much doubt.
But it's part of their PR strategy.
They haven't said build back better.
They have. Yes,
have they?
They
Who
have.
Said that then?
In a World Health Organization document.
Oh.
Tens of millions, this is point seven, driven into debt and therefore not having the confidence through lowered morale or the financial confidence and resources to fight back against forces which undermine their livelihood and that of their family and their loved ones. Well, I mean, we've been seeing that really ever since the 1980s, haven't we?
You have, and of course the other thing that's happened...
This is going to make an enormous
difference. The other thing
difference.
That's happened with all of this is the developing countries are now in a liquidity trap where they can't pay their debts in dollars, and so that allows a huge capital flight into the United States, which means that they can basically cream off the resources of developing countries and enslave them
in a way it's this point number seven I find most fascinating. So it's talking about morale, it's actually destroying the public's morale to fight back. That's what they're talking about here against the oligarchy effectively.
Yeah, but of course the fly in the ointment is the one quarter of humanity under the rule of the Chinese Communist Party.
So you will like this one. A convenient political cover to bail out failed banks, even more so than 2008, saddled with a further wave of unpayable debt, which by laws of the free market should be allowed to go bankrupt.
Well, there are no laws of the free market, but yes, there should be.
Well, it's a bit inverted commas around the free market, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, inverted commas around laws as well, because in actual fact, there are no laws. They're just predictions. Well, of course, that's exactly the point. This is the point I would make. The idea was, if we can look at Wuhan is at the center of the Chinese communication system. And this all happened just at Chinese New Year, where it was definitely spread very fast and very quickly. And then, of course, you could have a situation where the Chinese economy was completely messed up by COVID. And then, of course, you allow it to flow back over your own setup so that you've got an excuse to bail the banks out. The banks started collapsing in September 2019.
Okay, point nine, excuse to reinstitute policies of austerity, which leaders promised to reverse.
Yes.
Now, that's Boris, obviously, what is one of those.
Yes, I mean, what's happened now, we've seen this, the government's been forced to spend loads and loads of money because of the crisis, and that, now they're trying to say, well, that means we're going to have austerity further down the line to pay the money back, and of course they've already done that with the decisions that were taken this week not to fund school meals over the holidays.
And in the UK, an attack on the close-knit communities in urban centres of Northern England, traditional trade union heartlands. That, to me, we've got an enormous disparity, haven't we, between the measures being taken in the north and the south. It's like the home counties are going to be left to just carry on as normal, almost.
Well, I mean, that's the main point Andrew Burnham was making, was that now London is in tier two. They've suddenly discovered that we're going to give money for tier two, whereas in actual fact we've been in tier two lockdown for 3 months and we didn't get a penny.
Interesting, isn't it? It does seem as if this is just the traditional kind of war on the north by the Tory South.
Well, that's the way it's being spun by Labour politicians.
Oh, interesting. 11.11, economic consequences cause financial crash, which enables financiers and Treasury to up interest rates, plunge billions of homeowners into negative equity, disempowering and demoralising them, so they're less likely to fight back. Again, it's this morale thing, Martin, or to donate to popular social movements.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't had the crash yet because what they've been doing is printing money. But I think they're going to carry on printing money. That's what's going to happen. They've been printing money in Japan since the 1980s and they've never stopped. Once you get into this position, that's all you can do. And of course, Rishi Sunak trying to draw back. And of course, it just doesn't work. And of course, the Tories are going to have to accept that ultimately the deficit is going to have to go where the deficit's going to go, unless you completely reboot the economy on a socialist basis,
okay, so
which they're not prepared to do.
Final point, number 12, which is, I would imagine, fairly non-contentious with you anyway, is manufactured crisis cover for opening of a new front against Russia in Azerbaijan. Very close in the Caucasus to divide Russia and Iran and add to the headaches the West has created for Moscow in Belarus, Donbass, Afghanistan, Syria, etc. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov is the world's greatest chess player, constantly blocking NATO moves in the Middle East and elsewhere. It's creating a massive, desperate demand for tests, PPE and medical equipment for intensive care units, etc., which can be supplied at enormous profit margins by favoured clique insider individuals primed to do so and given loans to prepare mid-late 2019 and early 2020. I think that's actually 2 points I've rolled into one there. This business of Lavrov being a master chess player.
Well, I think this is where I possibly... I mean, he is very good. He's a very highly skillful diplomat. There isn't just one force out there. You've got to see this. This is ultimately like the 9/11 attacks as well. It's about geopolitical power. The US empire, basically, is attempting, you know, the Faustian bid for world dominance. And there are other forces at work in China, Russia and elsewhere, attempting to prevent this power grab.
So one of the groups which started up right in the early days of the lockdowns was a group called Stand Up X. And I just thought I'd do a little bit of digging around some of the founders of that organisation, only to find that London's Colombian-born Stand Up X leader, Nacho Iggs Saltz, is an alleged cocaine dealer who was apparently given some sort of immunity by the police. So it could be that he is, you know, compromised in some way. Now, this is obviously alleged. I have to use the word alleged. But Nacho Iggs Saltz, he was playing a major part in the movement against the lockdown in the early days, Martin.
Well, I think it's quite possible, as we know, that everything that's all political forces are infiltrated and are being manipulated. And, you know, the protesters in Belarus, many of them very genuine, I'm sure. But there's no doubt in my mind that they are being funded and directed by Western intelligence services. They just are. And that's not necessarily a big deal. It's just a fact. And the same things will be going on. I mean, the 9/11 truth movement, as you know, Tony, there are certain elements within it, like I'm thinking of Alex Jones, for example, who are effectively controlled opposition. And so that at one stage you allow people to question things, but then you start feeding in all sorts of other, you know, he's basically become an Islamophobic nutcase. And that's a way of, and this is counterintelligence propaganda operations by the FBI in the 1970s and 1980s. This is what you do, is you basically infiltrate everything and create a cacophony of misinformation. And propaganda is actually geared to different segments of the population, depending on their pre-existing political and other prejudices.
The idea here is that the oligarchy wants to control all sides of the chessboard. They know that there's going to be some sort of movement against this emerge, and they would like to control the early days of it.
That's right. So you in Gladio in Italy, you've got the fascists planting bombs to get the left wing going, and then when the left wing get going, you make sure that you're controlling them as well, so that they do stupid stuff like, you know, and basically Aldo Moro, the moderate prime minister of Italy, was kidnapped supposedly by the Red Brigades, but it wasn't the Red Brigades, it was actually Sismi itself that did it.
So what do you make of this enormous battle up north, particularly Cardiff and the south of Wales? It's a much shorter period of time. There doesn't seem to have been quite so much of a hoo-ha down there. Maybe that's because the debate has been stifled, both by the media and in the Welsh Parliament. But what do you make of this enormous clash that's going on in the north of England, Martin?
Well, I mean,
between Andy Burnham and Boris
and
Rishi Sunak.
Well, don't forget that Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have got different, you know, they're basically allowed to make different regulations. Andy Burnham and the other people in the north are under the orders of central government in Whitehall. So they are, you know, and they haven't got any resources either.
England doesn't have its own assembly, yes, a regional assembly either.
Well, no, it doesn't. And so, in other words, we've got basically a spatchcock. You know, there is no constitution in Britain. There's just a series of you know, bodged jobs that we've done over the years to supposedly create, you know, a democratic society. But of course, it isn't. And of course, what Burnham and the Northern mayors were most upset about is if we're going to be put into these strong lockdowns, you've got to give us resources to keep people fed and to keep them roofs open.
Okay, well, we're going to have a look at the Wales lockdown in a minute, but first let's have a listen to Boris, and then after that Andy Burnham, and then after that someone else who's one of the campaigners from Liverpool about the Liverpool resistance to what's been going on, the orders that have been coming up from Westminster. So Boris first on the big lockdown of the North, the Tier 3.
In recent months, we have worked with local leaders to counter local spikes with targeted restrictions. But this local approach has inevitably produced different sets of rules in different parts of the country that are now complex to understand and to enforce. So, just as we simplified our national rules with the rule of six, we will now simplify and standardise our local rules by introducing a three-tiered system of local COVID alert levels in England are set at medium, high and very high. The medium alert level will cover most of the country, which will cover most of the country and will consist of the current national measures. This includes the rule of six and the closure of hospitality at 10 p.m. The high alert level reflects the interventions in many local areas at the moment. This primarily aims to reduce household-to-household transmission by preventing all mixing between different households or support bubbles indoors. In these areas, the rule of six will continue to apply outdoors, where it is harder for the virus to spread, in public spaces as well as private gardens. Most areas which are already subject to local restrictions will automatically move into the high alert level. As a result of rising infection rates, Nottinghamshire, East and West Cheshire, and a small area of High Peak will also move into the high alert level. The very high alert level will apply where transmission rates are rising most rapidly and where the NHS could soon be under unbearable pressure without further restrictions. In these areas, the government will set a baseline of prohibiting social mixing indoors and in private gardens and, I'm sorry to say, closing pubs and bars. We want to create the maximum possible local consensus behind this more severe local action. So in each area, we will work with local government leaders on the additional measures which should be taken. This could lead to further restrictions on the hospitality, leisure, entertainment, or personal care sectors. But retail, schools, and universities will remain open. As my right honourable friend the Chancellor has set out, the government will expand its unprecedented economic support to assist those affected by these decisions, extending our job support scheme to cover two-thirds of the wages of those in any business that is required to close, and providing those businesses with a cash grant of up to £3,000 a month instead of £1,500 every 3 weeks. We will also provide local authorities across England with around £1 billion of new financial support on top of our £3.6 billion towns fund. And for very high areas, we will give further financial support for local test and trace and local enforcement, and assistance from the armed forces, not for enforcement, but rather to support local services, if desired, in the local area.
So there's Boris, part of his statement earlier this week, announcing this terrible bad news, particularly for the north of England, Martin.
Yeah. And, of course, it's very confusing for everybody because you've got all these different regulations in different parts of the country. And, you know, obviously what people had hoped was that by now we would be getting away from all of this. But, of course, we're not.
One of the big victims of this are going to be people in care homes.
Well, they are vulnerable like lots of other people are. I mean, the real
no contact with loved ones.
No, indeed, and
this is barbaric, isn't
it? Well, even if we went for a herd immunity strategy, which I certainly don't
it's
agree with.
It's barbaric, stopping people having contact with their loved ones.
No, but if you, I'm just making the point,
for,
Tony.
Well, we're now talking about 8-9 months. What's
going
on?
Yes, I know. Well, but if you're pursuing a herd immunity strategy, you would have to actually cut those people off completely.
That's not true. No, it's not true at all. The herd immunity strategy means that the younger generation, the people who are not going to die from COVID, catch it. That's the herd immunity.
Yes, but that means that they cannot go. You've got to shelter the so-called vulnerable, which is actually impossible. Which is why nobody's discussing herd immunity strategy. So I'm sorry I brought it up, but I'm just pointing out that there are no good options once you've got to this point. But of course, China. Everybody's back to work.
If only you would move to China, Martin.
You'd move to Saudi Arabia, Tony, because they're your allies, aren't you?
No, they're not my allies at all. But you are always going on about how wonderful China is.
Me making a comment.
I mean, China is an authoritarian regime where you can do these things.
Yes.
And you think that's the way to do it.
South Korea and Taiwan, the Republic of China, has also had a very good COVID war.
And what's just happened in South Korea? We've got a story about that a little bit later with a load of people dying from some vaccine trial. Anyway, let's have a listen to Andy Burnham, because we're trying to talk about, rather than China, about the north of England here.
People here in Greater Manchester have been living under restrictions for 3 months, and they have taken a heavy toll on people. They're struggling. Businesses are on the brink of closure. To accept any further restrictions in these circumstances would be certain to increase levels of poverty, homelessness and hardship within our city region. Let's be clear who is most affected by a tier 3 lockdown. It is people working in pubs, in bookies, driving taxis, people too often forgotten by those in power. But this city region has never walked on by, and it never will. At the start of these negotiations, together with the leaders of our councils, we made a commitment to all of those people that we would look out for them and stand up for what is right. It cannot be right. It cannot be right to close people's place of work, to shut somebody's business without giving them proper support so that they can look after themselves, their families, through a very challenging winter that lies ahead of us. So we've been clear throughout, we could only accept further restrictions with full financial support. We put forward a costed package of measures, a detailed package of measures, but in particular to support people on the lowest incomes and people who are self-employed. £15 million a month was what we costed was needed to support people across the 10 boroughs that make up Greater Manchester. These would be people who would need support to top up the furlough to 80%, recognising that people can't live on 2/3 of their wages. People who are self-employed also with 80% of their income so that they could make ends meet. That was the commitment that we made. So this would cost £90 million to the end of the financial year. In negotiations with the government, we were prepared to reduce our request to £75 million, and we even were prepared to go even lower, £65 million as the bare minimum, to prevent a winter of real hardship here. That is what we believe we needed to prevent poverty, to prevent hardship, to prevent homelessness. Those were the figures that we had, not what we wanted, what we needed to prevent all of those things happening. But the government refused to accept this. And at 2 o'clock today, they walked away from negotiations. In summary, at no point today were we offered enough to protect the poorest people in our communities through the punishing reality of the winter to come. Even now, I am still willing to do a deal, but it cannot be on the terms that the government offered today, because on those terms, I could not meet the commitments I made to people on the lowest incomes, to people who are self-employed, to the freelancers in this city who need our support. I could not do it on those terms. And I don't think it is right to ask people to go into a lockdown, to accept further changes within their lives without supporting them through all of that and what it entails. It can't be right to do that. How can we carry the public with us through this pandemic if we are forcing them to lose their income, their place of work, without supporting them through that? How is that going to keep people with what's being done here to fight this virus? So finally, I don't believe we can proceed as a country on this basis through the pandemic by grinding communities down through punishing financial negotiations. We are asking a lot of the public at this difficult time, and we need to carry them with us, not crush their spirit. We need national unity, and that is why I now look to Parliament to intervene and make a judgment on a fair financial framework for Tier 3 lockdowns.
Okay, so the long and short of that from Andy Burnham, Martin, is we're okay about locking down, but you can't do it on the cheap.
Which is absolutely correct. I mean, if you're going to have a severe lockdown like that, leaving aside whether it's justifiable or not, but if you're going to do that, you've got to back it up with hard cash. And of course, what you're doing here is a tension is developing within the Tory government between those who don't want to spend any more money. And we saw this very clearly in the vote about extending school meals in the school holidays. The Tories were whipped to vote against it. Five of them did vote against it, but they've had to resign from the government. But I suspect what will happen with that, Marcus Rashford hasn't given up. I think that the Tories are going to be forced to back down on that because after lashing loads of money into the hands of Rupert Soames and others, it just seems completely ridiculous that you're not prepared to pay for kids to have their school lunches.
Okay, so yes, I mean, the idea that children should be the victim of this and the government hasn't got enough money to pay. I mean, actually, what it does seem to me is that this has proven that Goldman Sachs and Rishi Sunak have got a magic money tree. They can help out any of their mates they want.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why the Tories are starting to get cold feet, because they've now admitted that there is, in fact, a magic money tree. There always was. In fact, there's a magic money orchard. And, of course, ultimately, they'll say, well, we can't just keep spending money. And I feel like saying to them, I sent you an email about this last night, they should say that to the Japanese, because they've been spending money and quantitative easing and propping up their stock market since the 1980s. And, of course, that is the reality going forward. If we let the banks collapse, and no doubt they will collapse at some point, then the whole of capitalism is finished. So they've just got to keep printing money. They could, and Rishi Sunak, of course, did hint that there were going to have to be wealth taxes to cover the deficit. But he was immediately savaged by the Tory press, because the wealthy in this country have got no intention of paying higher taxes to cover the crisis that's happened.
I mean, what's happening is, by having all these extra lockdowns, etc., the five tiers of crying, the lockdowns, whatever they are, in Scotland, they're about to introduce more of this as well, even though actually the death figures are virtually zero. There isn't any discussion or debate by the Labour Party about this at all. The idea is we want more money for the lockdowns, not we don't want a lockdown at all.
Well, that's right, Tony, and as you say, that is where the mainstream debate is. There are some, as you know, who don't think that lockdowns are a good idea, etc. Nobody likes them, and the point is that...
Well, some people do, don't they? I mean, surely people like Rishi Sunak or Bill Gates absolutely love them. Disruption as possible in the country before there's some sort of great reset. This is surely this is part of the cover for this massive bailout.
All right, but Rishi Sunak doesn't want to see lockdowns. He was the one that gave $600 million to give people... were already relatively well off a chance to go out and eat in restaurants.
Anyway, this business of the north of England came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where the Labour leader Keir Starmer put it to Boris Johnson, Prime Minister.
This is a Prime Minister that can pay £7,000 a day for consultants on track and trace, which isn't working, that can find £43 million for a garden bridge that was never built, but he can't find £5 million for the people of Greater Manchester. I really think the Prime Minister's crossed a Rubicon here. not just with the miserly way that he's treated Greater Manchester, but the grub it, take it or leave it way these local deals are being done. It's corrosive to public trust, to pit region against region, mayor against mayor, council against council, asking them to trade away their businesses and jobs. We need a one nation approach. Replace these endless local battles with clear national criteria and proper support for jobs. Labour's motion this afternoon would do that. Why won't the Prime Minister support it?
Mr Speaker, I'm proud of the support that we've given, the one nation Conservative support that we've given to the entire country. £200 billion in support for jobs and livelihoods across the whole of the country already. A further £9.9 billion now for the Jobs Support Scheme. It is this government that has cut VAT for business, deferred business rates. There is no other country in Europe, Mr Speaker, where so much support, so much help has been given to the population to get through this crisis, and we will continue to do that. But I think it is the height of absurdity, Mr Speaker, that he stands up and attacks the economic consequences of the measures that we're obliged to take across some parts of the country when he wants to turn the lights out with a full national lockdown, taking kids... That was his policy last week anyway, wasn't it? Perhaps he could confirm that's still his policy. Is that what he wants to do?
I think that is what he wants to do, and that's what they are doing in Wales. But, of course, if you're going to do that, you've got to give people the relevant support. And, of course, the other thing that you've got to do is you've got to get a test and trace system where you can actually basically squash the virus down, which is basically in the successful countries. That's what they've done.
So before we go to Wales, I thought we'd have a listen to Nottingham, because it's one of those places, like Bristol, which has had an enormous increase in the number of positive tests. Whether they're true or false is another question, because of an influx of university students. So it seems like most of the big university cities, Martin, are coming up as sort of blipping red on the graph around the country. But actually, many of these students are actually themselves locked down in the university. So there may be cases, positive tests within those student populations, but the students are not allowed to leave the campus.
Yeah, and of course, the other thing that they, if they are allowed to leave the campus, they could, this is what Andy Burnham's saying about Manchester. We've got a very high student population here, and this is why we've got a massive increase. I mean, you could have argued that maybe they shouldn't have sent the university students back. Well, I'm working in schools, of course, and the people who are going into local schools are all local people. University students in Britain tend to come from all sorts of different
and
places.
And international students, too.
Yes. Well, they're international students haven't been able to get in, have they?
Well, yeah, they have, actually. There's a lot in Bristol University. I've heard there's only about 40% of the international students have arrived this term.
Well, there you are.
But they can get in, but they don't want to. Most of them don't want to. Anyway, let's go to Nottingham now to look at what's happened to this university city.
Lillian Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. His government lost control of the virus, making extra restrictions inevitable. But with no certainty, no communication and no new financial support, he's killing Nottingham businesses. Castle Rock Brewery is a Nottingham success story, but now it's on the verge of breakdown. Two pubs closed permanently, jobs gone, and worried staff facing the prospect of being laid off with no pay. Countless other bars, restaurants and pubs tell the same story. Will he stop punishing successful Nottingham businesses for his failure and give them the help they desperately need?
Well, Mr Speaker, I of course sympathise deeply with businesses that face difficulties because of the pandemic, though I would remind her that in her constituency the infection rate is now running at 815 per 100,000, and we must get that down. And I thank the people of Nottingham for what they're doing to get it down. And we will, of course, continue to provide the full panoply of support that we've offered and more throughout this crisis.
Well, I mean, he's basically saying we've given you enough money and you're just going to have to suck it up. But, of course, they keep changing what they're saying. So Rishi Sunak is now basically coming back and saying, well, you know what we said last week? We couldn't afford this and this and this. We've decided that we can afford it. Just as when they backed down previously over Marcus Rashford's campaign over school dinners. And I think that just shows that they're at sixes and sevens, aren't they? They're not quite sure what they're trying to do. They've got lots of different messages for different parts of the population. And fundamentally, the Labour Party now are moving into an attack mode. Up to now, they've been generally, Starmer taking over as the leader of the opposition was quite cautious in the way he was approaching things. But I think by calling for the lockdown, because he knew that Sage had called for it, he's put the Tories on the spot. They've got to now defend not doing what the scientists told them to do.
So let's go to Wales now and have a listen to the First Minister, Labour First Minister Mark Drakeford, and his 2 week or two and a bit week Halloween circuit break, he's calling it, which is a lockdown in Wales. So let's have a listen to that announcement earlier this week.
I and my cabinet colleagues are absolutely aware of the demands that we are making of our fellow citizens here in Wales as we ask everyone to stay at home and require businesses to shut. Of course, we are all tired of coronavirus and the many rules and regulations with which we have to live our lives. We all want to see an end to this pandemic and our lives returned to us once again. Unfortunately, we do not yet have a vaccine which will allow that to happen. And a fire break period is our best chance of regaining control of the virus and avoiding a much longer and much more damaging national lockdown. The window we have within which to act is only a small one. And to be successful, we need everybody's help. Here in Wales, this is the moment to come together, to play our part in a common endeavour, to do everything we can together to protect the NHS and to save lives. And if we do this, our health service will be able to care for people with coronavirus and everybody else. Those people who need emergency treatment, those people who need treatment for cancer, those people suffering from strokes or from heart disease. That will be possible provided we take this opportunity. And most importantly of all, it will save people's lives. Of course, this will not be easy, but if we act together, we can succeed. Once again, diolch o galon I chi gyd am popeth chi'n wneud. Thank you all so much for everything you have already done and for everything that you will do over the weeks to come. Together, we can still keep Wales safe.
So that's the Welsh First Minister Mark Drakeford announcing the fire break for 2.5 weeks or so. But the debate, which took place this week at the Welsh Parliament, I was quite interested to see that the member of the Welsh Parliament, Simon McEvoy, who's a former Labour and former Plaid Cymru member of the Assembly at the Synod, he was stopped from even speaking in that debate. And I had a chat with him earlier this week, actually went over to Cardiff to speak to him, and it turns out that he's also been very absolutely strong campaigner against the dumping of this plutonium mud from Hinkley Power Station over in Cardiff Bay. So I started by asking him about that, but he went on to then talk about his reaction to the firebreak lockdown, which is happening for 2 weeks, and he doesn't believe it's only going to be 2 weeks either.
What we've proven is that there was a huge spike of plutonium in 1984 being released with no corresponding gamma spike. So you would not have, if you only tested for gamma, there would be no alarm bells raised, but you would miss the plutonium. So we've already had 80,000 tonnes of it dumped on us. I'm trying to find out from where it came in the estuary. I hope to God it wasn't anywhere near the waste pipe. We just don't know. Nobody will answer those questions, but we're going to keep on asking. What they want to do now is come back and take up to finish the project, or to enable the project to go to the next stage of building the nuclear power station. They want to dig up 780,000 tonnes of mud, from the seabed. And, I mean, bizarrely, the Welsh Government is welcoming that being dumped on Wales. We're not even getting paid for it.
I don't quite understand why they need to get rid of all this mud, because as I understand it, the Severn Estuary is full of mud, and if they take the mud away, within a few years it'll just return.
I think they needed to complete the whatever they're building on that side of the water with Hinkley Point C. They need to dig it up to build whatever they need to build.
They're going to build something kind of below the sea line, below the shoreline, and they're going to need to remove the mud in order to build something there. Yeah. Do you think that the power station there will ever be up and running?
I hope not. But I don't know. It's a fight. We're not giving up, and we're doing our level best to let people know that this is happening, because no media outlets in Wales has, with the exception of a small blog called nation.cymru, they've not reported it. So I actually do a Facebook Live, we have a presentation, thousands of people watch it, we present evidence of the plutonium leaking into the estuary, therefore into the mud, they want to dump on us. BBC are not interested, ITV are not interested, Channel 4 are not interested. It just beggars belief, really.
The end of this week, there's going to be a lockdown for 2 weeks, actually a bit longer than 2 weeks, through Halloween. How's that going down amongst people around here?
Badly. At the end of this week, we're facing another lockdown in Wales, which has been brought in by the Welsh Government without any idea of how they're going to fund the lockdown in terms of people's employment. We're looking at economic chaos and real hardship, and I'm not seeing any kind of science to tell the public why this needs to happen. I voted for the first lockdown back in March. I didn't think there was a choice then. I've since the new term, September, I've voted against all the local lockdowns in Wales. I'm voting against the lockdown on Friday. I mean, we're in a situation where we have to learn to live with the virus. We have to start behaving differently. We have to carry on with our lives. The virus is there. I don't subscribe to people who say that it doesn't exist. It is there. It can kill anyone, actually, but as we know, predominantly it will kill certain categories of people. So what we need to do is go about our daily business as safely as possible, and a bit differently. But what the Welsh Government is doing is just closing everything down. I mean, me and my wife went out for a meal last Friday, outdoor restaurant, lovely, distance, no chance of catching COVID. I mean, completely safe. They're going to have to close down. People are going to lose jobs. And gyms are closing. There are gyms in the city, all over, really, where you can exercise safely. You know, we're not talking about huge groups of people exercising together. It can be done properly. It can be done safely. We need to maybe bring in COVID A-star certification, maybe, whereby businesses can operate safely. Locking things down, all we're doing is postponing. We're kicking the can down the road, and we're not listening to the World Health Organization. We should be testing. There should have been mass testing in March. I'm not saying anything new here. There wasn't. The Welsh Government did not listen to the World Health Organization.
I mean, we've had an enormous pushback in Manchester against this. Andy Burnham, the mayor, saying, if you're going to have a lockdown, then we need to be compensated, otherwise you're not having a lockdown. Has there been anything similar here in Cardiff?
No. I mean, the Welsh Government, can I be polite and say that, I mean, they're just idiots. I mean, they wear a red rosette, people automatically vote Labour in Wales. That is changing. And I think this lockdown now is going to make them realise that they will be held politically accountable, and that's the whole mission of the Welsh Nation Party. We're fed up with these people in there behaving as they like, not listening to the public, making decisions without any accountability. We're going to make them accountable, and I think this lockdown is going to be the turning point in Welsh politics, actually.
Whereabouts can people find the Welsh Nation Party and follow your work, Neil?
www.wnp.wales, and if you go into Facebook, it's Neil J. McEvoy, that's McEvoy. Just follow me on Facebook, and there's plenty of videos. Take a look at what I do. I'm a politician out there every week. I work every day, and I'm privileged to be elected by people, and I do my best. If you're in trouble, you can walk into my office, and we will do our level best to help you. We may not always be successful, but what we will guarantee is that we will try to the best of our ability, and that's what it's all about, really.
Neil McAvoy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
OK, so that's Neil McAvoy from the Welsh Assembly. Martin, he's saying effectively that that there is a kind of political elite establishment in Wales that's just doing this without... I mean, for example, he voted against this current, the firebreak lockdown, but he wasn't allowed to speak at all in the debate. So he did a Facebook Live, which has got tens of thousands of views.
Well, I mean, I hear what he has to say. I don't suppose he won. I mean, they had a vote on it. And they voted to carry on as they suggested.
Well, I mean, in an extended interview I did with him, which I'll put a link up to on our show page, he takes you really through the depth of political corruption there is in Wales, but both within Labour and Plaid Cymru, where he talks about not really being able to do his job. He's being told, you know, that Plaid Cymru has come to an agreement with Labour about this, and you're not allowed to challenge them, for example.
Well, as you say, he used to be in the Labour Party, then he defected to Plaid Cymru.
No, he didn't defect. He was taken out of the Labour Party, and he was taken out of Plaid Cymru
on
disciplinaries of various sorts. Because he wasn't towing the line in every way.
Well, I don't know enough about his particular
history. What you can do is have a listen to the interview I did with him earlier this week. It's around about an hour long altogether. If you've got the time to listen, it's a fascinating insight into Welsh politics.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, he's you know, he's got his views.
We will hear a little bit more from him, though, and that is where, because one of the things he champions is whistleblowers. So there are a lot of whistleblowers that will go both to BBC Wales, the Welsh media, or to Plaid Cymru, or to Labour, and get absolutely nowhere. That is not the case with Simon McAvoy.
My golden rule is that a whistleblower can come to me, they can tell me what they like, and I will not publicise it unless they want me to. Like that's one of my rules, unless it's criminal, of course, and I'm obliged to do something that way. But probably the most recent one is Velindra Hospital, which I've taken a lot of a lot of fire over, because people are lying, so I'm opposing a new cancer hospital in Cardiff. I'm not, but the model, doctors have come to me saying that the model is flawed, there are no emergency beds, there's no surgical provision, so the latest treatments will not be available in the new hospital. It's used to be called the PFI, Private Finance Initiative. They're calling it the Mutual Investment Model now, and it's basically the same. The public sector pays four times as much, and they will not own the hospital at the end of it. So doctors, frightened for their careers, experts in cancer have come to me and laid out their clinical concerns. So I've spoken up on that matter recently. I've asked questions. None of the questions have been answered yet. So that's one, which is that's a major one, that is, because I want the best cancer hospital possible in this city to serve South Wales. And I also want it in the right place. At the moment, it's going to go on a greenfield site, which is, it just doesn't make sense when there's a brownfield site right next door, which they want to sell. So I'm asking who they're going to sell it to and so on. There are lots of questions. So that's one. Some are quite amusing, but actually scandalous. There was a contract drawn up. Again, this is where... Let's get through to the real detail here. The contract was debated on the floor of the Senate, and ultimately, supposedly, for energy conservation. Companies were in a position where if you fit a light bulb, you're getting £240 for it. And I forget what the technical term is for reducing water flow, I think that was £125, and you were talking, people would actually having contracts go into, it didn't matter where it was, it wasn't targeted on, for example, low income families, it could be anywhere, they'd go in, the baseline was three, they'd fit three light bulbs generally, put a few of these things in the taps, and they'd walk away with, roughly £400 a house. And maybe £500 a house. It would take literally 10 minutes. So they'd be on to the next house next door. And somebody working in the industry had a conscience, because they were actually making money from it. And they just said, this is outrageous. And I blew the whistle on that one. It was called a scaremonger, called a liar, as usual. Back in 2010, 11, 12. I blew the whistle on what was going to happen to the green fields in Cardiff when they were going to be built on. I was called a liar. I was said to be misleading the public. The present First Minister called me a scaremonger. And then 3 weeks after, or 3 months after the election, of course, they announced that they were going to build on all the green fields.
Maybe Wales is the last honest politician, Martin. He can't survive as an honest man within the party political system.
Well, it's the first time I've ever come across him, and he sounds interesting. But of course, Private Finance Initiative.
It's called the MIM. The MIM, that is to say, the Mutual
Investment Model.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know,
that
rings true to me. And of course, there has been an element of, you know, Welsh local government and at national level, as it were, being very much, you know, the old guard that have always run it. All sounds very plausible.
What about this organisation he talks about in the longer interview? He talks about a company called Derrings, a lobbyist firm who have sharing directors with Ofcom, who are extremely close to Plaid Cymru. He's told by them, no, you can't speak on this, say that, and he's basically then bullied and targeted and booted out of Plaid.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very hard to comment because I just don't know exactly what his agenda
lobbying
is.
Lobbying firms are incredibly powerful, though, aren't
they? Oh, of
course
they are, yeah.
So the idea that they're linked to Ofcom too is even more concerning. I mean, a lobbying firm linked to a media regulator, to me, stinks.
Yes, it sounds, on the face of it, it sounds like this is exactly the sort of old boys network which we know runs the country at every level. No surprises there, eh?
Not for you in the Labour Party?
No. I mean, the Labour Party, especially when it's been in local, you know, those certain parts of the country where they were the establishment for years and years and years. Central Belt in Scotland, for example.
Okay, I'll put a link up to that on our show page as the article here in Wales Online. Ofcom admits it broke its own rules in giving a contract to a lobbying firm which was run by its own advisers. Former Labour and Plaid Cymru figures are directors of Derryn, DERYN, the company at the centre of the row. So they're actually, although they're on the floor of the House and in the pantomime of politics, Labour and Plaid are supposedly against each other, they're actually aligned on many issues and fixing votes, that sort of thing.
Well, that's right, but of course you've got a different political setup in Wales than you've got in the rest of the country, and it's got its own peculiarities, hasn't it?
So anyway, Neil McAvoy's his name. I'll put a link up to the full interview with him on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But look, back to the row in the north of England. I bumped into a guy called Geyser Tariani, who's a former children's entertainer who was put out of work through the COVID lockdown. He was also involved a couple of years ago a bit with campaigning against fracking up in the north of England. And I bumped into him here in Bristol's Castle Park earlier on this week, yesterday in fact, where he had quite a lot to say about what he thinks about the lockdowns and also some advice for people who want to create social movements to get Boris Johnson to do whatever is in the interests of the people.
There's a thing called the unknown, right? And the Agenda 21, what they've not planned for is the unknown. And all these things will happen, you know. And what's happened in Liverpool, they've tried to close the gyms. But they stood up to the government and they said, no, we're not doing it. But the government blinked first and they've allowed the gyms open now. So we're not paying the fine, so the government blinked first. Now the gyms in Liverpool have got the win, where they're now allowed to open. Now that is the wedge that we needed. So now you'll get leisure industry, you'll get the pubs, and they'll be saying, hold on a minute, why are they allowed to open, we're not? And then we'll then fight the fines, and that will snowball, and then we'll bring Boris Johnson down and Matt Hancock and the whole government.
People like this are actually endangering public health by trying to pretend there is no threat.
Oh, how about that you've got a treatment called hydroxychloroquine? See, if somebody's even tests for positive for coronavirus, then if they're given hydroxychloroquine within the first 5 days, then they're cured. Or it's also a prophylactic. If everybody in this country had hydroxychloroquine and they just took two tablets, that would then be protected for a whole month. So we won't need a vaccine, we won't need a health passport.
You're not a doctor, are you?
Don't need to be. We have doctors. We have doctors telling us this, and that's what it is. They're not listening to our doctors. They're not listening to our experts. They're listening to people that are part of the industry. People like Sir Patrick Vallance has got 600,000 shares in the global, who have been found guilty, by the way, GlaxoSmithKline, a British company. So he's got shares in them. You've got Chris Whitty, that's one of the advisors for Boris Johnson and the government, who has been who's got donations from Bill Gates. These people are set to profit from anything that goes on. But this is about depopulation. We've already lost thousands of people in this country unnecessarily. And then doctors, the good doctors around the world, will start coming out, like the frontline doctors in America, like Ericsson, again in America, that was telling us that this is a fraud. You know, and what we do, we then do our own research and realise that we're being conned. Now, what I say is, for that first month, you know, with Boris Johnson, we'll give him the first month, when people were dying in Wuhan mid-step, it was horrific. People having marbling on the lungs, big complexes being locked down and people dying in there. It was horrific. But after that month, they'd done the research, then by that time, they should have realised it was a con.
How do people follow your work online then?
Well, if you go to Geza Tarjani, G-E-Z-A, Tarjani, T-A-R-J-A-N-Y-I, everything I've done is on there. If one of people want to see my background of where we actually stopped a Tory government for 10 years, that's, you can stop a Tory government.
How?
You just go on Frack Free Filed, Frack Free, F-R-Y-L-D-E filed, and then you get my history. Are you beaten? It's hard work. Get it organised. Learning your enemy, and only working with the tools that you've got. Also, always work to your skills. Square peg round hole doesn't work in campaigning. You know, work to your skills. Whatever your skills are, bring that to the table, and never ever let another volunteer down. If you offer to do a job, do that job. Otherwise, it's going to cost too. One thing we haven't got now is time. We have no time. It has to end this year.
So that's Geza Tarjani, part of the campaign against fracking, a former kids entertainer, Martin, until the lockdown stopped all that. But he's frantically, I would say, almost going around the country talking to anyone that will listen about the tactics that you need to bring down Boris.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically straightforward, isn't it? You've got to get organised, but it's like saying that, you know, what we need is a game of football. You've got to kick the ball through the goal.
What do you make
not everybody can do it.
What's happened up with the gyms is very significant, isn't it? The gyms have said, well, look, we can open safely, and the government have caved in.
Well, except that they haven't caved in now. They've gone to level 3 lockdown, haven't they? I mean, but I'm not quite sure what the situation with gyms in Liverpool is as we speak.
Well, they've basically won. I mean, that's what's happening in Liverpool, as I understand it. I mean, I can double-check that if you want. Well, but as it certainly looks as if the gyms aren't now going to be allowed to stay open because they've basically taken a very tough stand. And I would imagine actually what's happened is that probably the police have played a role here in saying, look, we don't want to have to police this sort of thing. These guys have done everything they can to make sure that the gyms are safe. They're well ventilated, etc. And the people who are going to the gym are not elderly 80-year-olds, so we want to let them stay open.
Well, I don't know what the situation with gyms is in Liverpool, so I do not know what's been decided at all. So it's very, you know, I can't really make a comment.
Well, let's have a look, shall we? So the Liverpool gyms, I can't find anything on that. Maybe this is because it's Google, eh? Gyms in Liverpool. I'll check that out. But in the meantime, our last clip about the lockdown is coming from London, and it's one of the members of the London Assembly, David Curtin, K-U-R-T-E-N, grilling the mayor, Sadiq Khan, on his selective policing of the London protests.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and good morning. Now, you mentioned there's been a lot of demonstrations over the last few months, and there certainly have been. I've been at many of them. I was at the 3 different freedom rallies which took place in Trafalgar Square on the 26th of August, 19th of September, 26th of September, and I spoke at one of them on the 19th of September. But I was quite shocked, particularly by the behaviour of the TSG riot police on the 26th of September, because the demonstration was absolutely, completely peaceful, unlike some of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations where police were attacked, a woman was thrown off her horse, flares were lit, and the flag at the cenotaph was burned. That happened at the BLM demonstrations. But on the 26th of September, columns of riot police waded into the crowds, batons drawn, people were injured, people's faces were bloodied, a woman was pushed off her chair. That, to me, is unacceptable behaviour from that unit of the Metropolitan Police. Who gave the order for that to happen?
Chairman, I'm not sure if... I just don't know enough about the facts. I'm not sure I can accept the premise of the facts set up by the
right.
member.
Would you accept that's acceptable behaviour by that unit of the Metropolitan Police?
Well, Chair, I hope I said it in my... I gave quite a full answer, explaining how operationally these things work with gold, silver and bronze, and the experience of individual commanders. But if the member has particular issues or a complaint to make about police conduct on that day, I suggest he takes them up with both the MPS and the MPC, which is the appropriate thing to do rather than this forum. I'm not abreast of the facts. And I can't, you know, determine.
Well, what I can ask you about is your tweets, because on the 26th of September, you tweeted, "This is not acceptable. I urge all protesters to leave now. Large gatherings are banned for a reason. You are putting the safety of our city at risk." That was you. Whereas on the Black Lives Matter demonstration, you put out a statement saying, "I stand with you and I share your anger and your pain." Now, they're completely different messages you put out about the Black Lives Matter one, which actually, there was a lot of violence, you seemed to support it, but the other one, the entirely peaceful demonstration at the Freedom Rally, you said it's not acceptable. So why did you put out the different statements there?
Well, I think, Chair, the members in danger have not turned the entire picture, which is since the 20th of August, which is the BLM demonstration has been talked about, national legislation has changed, which has meant gatherings of more than 30 people have been banned, save for specific circumstances. And he also omits to mention that on the 26th of September, 9 police officers were injured at that demonstration. So it's really important to tell the complete picture rather than cherry-picking some of them.
Sorry, Mr. Mayor. I mean, those 9 police officers wouldn't have been injured if they hadn't have waded into the crowd. But you mentioned the 20th of August. Let's look at last week, because last weekend there was a demonstration of, well, a rally of 3,000 Shia Muslims gathered in Marble Arch for Ashura and marched up Edgware Road. And then on Sunday, the next day, there was another gathering where, again, a large crowd of Shia Muslims gathered at Marble Arch for Arbaeen and marched down Park Lane. So are you saying then, on the basis of what you've just said, large gatherings shouldn't be allowed? Why were those demonstrations allowed, and why did you not say anything about those, whereas you did say something about the 26th of September Freedom Rally?
I've not got those facts with me, Chair. I'm happy to take them away and get a response sent to the member offline.
Fine. I think you should be consistent, Mr. Mayor, if you're putting out the message there.
So that's one of the members in London really criticising Sadiq Khan. Didn't he seem to have much of an answer for any of that, did he?
Well, he didn't. I mean, it's quite possible.
He's a bit
didn't.
Like you, sort of prevaricating, so I don't know anything about this.
Well, I don't, because obviously I don't.
Well, I'm trying to find out about
as the mayor of London, he may or may not have known what was going on any one of the demonstrations.
I would suggest
that
he would be
about.
Very much involved with the policing of London, actually, in a direct kind of line manager style fashion.
Well, he may or may not be
with the chiefs of the Metropolitan Police, and if anything happens that he might find politically embarrassing, he can just say, "Oh, I didn't know anything about it."
Well, when we had the Black Lives Matter protest,
when we had the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol,
where you know Colston went into the dock, the decision on the policing on that day was made by the police. They certainly didn't consult with the mayor.
I would have thought they almost certainly did consult with the mayor.
The mayor did, in fact, in Bristol, was he closed the centre of the city, so he was aware of the demonstrations, but the decision to police in that particular style on that particular day would have been made by the Avon and Somerset police.
Certainly, my understanding of the way these things work is the chief constable usually has a word, almost always, on anything important political demonstration, will have a word with the mayor, and that these things are generally worked out between the two of them.
Yes, that may be so, but ultimately the decision on policing is an operational decision. I don't believe in elected police and crime commissioners.
Isn't that what the police are there for?
Yes.
They are there to take the flak if things get
well,
embarrassing.
Well, they are there to make the decision. It's actually an operational decision by police officers. If you've got a demonstration, you can either say, right, you've all got to go home, or you may conclude that more harm is done by trying to drive everybody home
than
by letting
it happen.
Well, say,
for example, in London, the last thing Cressida Dick, the chief constable of the Met, wants is a row with Sadiq Khan, saying afterwards, after the event, I think that was the terrible decision, the wrong decision, etc.
Yes, and of course, by consulting, they then make the decision with all of the facts. But you're going to find different police forces are going to adopt a different strategy for dealing with what they regard as public order situations. And it's going to depend upon the mood on the day, all sorts of things. And it's not necessary, there isn't necessarily just one size fits all. These decisions are operational decisions for the police for a reason.
Okay, well, before we wind up and we hear from David Livingston a bit about the links between Aleister Crowley's OTO and the Zionists, and also that speech from Colonel Gaddafi from 2009, here's a little short song from Stormzy, and that is supposedly like Keir Starmer, called Bossy Cop.
Murky. I whip to abstain, I'm a bossy cop. I'll give you 12 months for looting body shop. For spy cops, I'll be right there at the lobby top. As far as I'm concerned, they should be using bloody novichok. Look, I whip to abstain, I'm a bossy cop. I'll give you 12 months for looting body shop. Should be 20 points ahead against this shoddy lot. Frankly though, I'll settle just for seeing all you stroppy trots. Look, I didn't mean a word, let's be honest. Basically reneged on every promise. My target audience is Lord Adonis. Cash for access to boost profits.
Thank God.
Been around the block, I'm not a novice. Inspected any number of your wallets.
Your wallets.
Now is not the time to just demolish.
Demolish.
Let's help the government and help Boris.
Yeah.
Pass the bill. Licensing to kill. Another raw breed making trouble at the mill. Agents of the state can infiltrate you at will. So beware of secret agents saying Netflix and chill. They'll be coming through your door like Jack Torrance.
Jack Torrance.
Unconstrained by any kind of warrant.
Kind of warrant.
Historically no kind of tolerance for justice for Hillsborough or even Stephen Lawrence. Target number one, social movements. Climate activists and trade unions. Anything remotely pro-humans. You're officially classified as a nuisance. Sound the bugle on the hunt. Forensic drone strike if you spark up a blunt. Jess Phillips, grinning like a cunt. Now it's legal to stab Jeremy Corbyn in the front. I whip to abstain, I'm a bossy cop.
Hey,
I'll give you 12 months for looting body shop.
Hey,
for spy cops, I'll be right there at the lobby top. As far
hey.
As I'm concerned, they should be using bloody novichok. Look, I whip to abstain, I'm a bossy cop.
Hey,
I'll give you 12 months for looting body shop.
Hey,
should be 20 points ahead against the shoddy lot.
Hey.
Frankly though, I'll settle just for seeing all you stroppy trots.
Hey.
Stormzy there. So we're going now and have a look at back into time. It's 10 years ago still, well, actually 11 years ago, when Muammar Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi, spoke at the UN General Assembly. It'd be really interesting, Martin, to hear what you've got to say about this, because this is a 5-minute clip, but it's his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, which is really saying so much of what we say week after week. So I do want to get your opinion as to Gaddafi, you know, whether he is some sort of devil or one of the greatest rulers Africa's ever had. Here he is from 2009, September, at the UN.
Prisoners of war held in Abu Ghraib prison were tortured. Dogs were set on them. Men were raped. This is the unprecedented in the history of war. It was sodomy, and it was an unprecedented sin, never before committed by past aggressors or invaders. Prisoners of war are soldiers, but these were raped in prison by a state, a permanent member of the Security Council. This goes against civilization and humankind. We must not keep silent. We must know the facts. Even today, 250,000 of Iraqi prisoners, men and women alike, remain in Abu Ghraib. They are being maltreated, persecuted and raped. There must be an investigation. turning to the war in Afghanistan, this too must be investigated. Why are we against the Taliban? Why are we against Afghanistan? Who are the Taliban? If the Taliban want a religious state, that's fine. Think of the Vatican. Does the Vatican pose a threat to us? No, it's a religious, very peaceful state. If the Taliban want to create an Islamic emirate, who says that this makes them an enemy? Is anyone claiming that bin Laden is of the Taliban or that he is Afghan? Is bin Laden of the Taliban? No. He is not of the Taliban and he is not an Afghan. Were the terrorists who hit New York of the Taliban? Were they from Afghanistan? They were neither Taliban nor Afghani. Then what was the reason for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? If I truly wanted to deceive my American and British friends, I would encourage them to send more troops and I would encourage them to persist in this bloodbath. But they will never succeed in Iraq or Afghanistan. Look what happened to them in Iraq, which is a desert. It's even worse in mountainous Afghanistan. If I wanted to see them, I would tell them to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But no, I want to save the citizens of the United States, the United Kingdom, and other countries who are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I tell them, leave Afghanistan to the Afghans. Leave Iraq to the Iraqis. If they want to fight each other, they are free to do so. America had its civil war, and no one interfered in it. There were civil wars in Spain, China, and countries all over the world. No place on earth has been free of civil wars. Let there be a civil war in Iraq. If the Iraqis want to have a civil war and fight each other, that's fine. Who says that if the Taliban form a government, they would possess intercontinental missiles of the kind of airplanes that hit New York? Did those airplanes take off from Afghanistan or Iraq? No, they took off from American airports. So why is Afghanistan being struck? The terrorists were not Afghans or Taliban or Iraqis. Why are we silent? We must never be war devils. Anyone who does not speak the truth is a silent devil. We are committed to international peace and security. We do not wish to scorn or ridicule humankind. We want to save humanity. As President of the General Assembly, Mr. Ali Trekkie should open an investigation of the assassinations file in addition to the war files. Who killed Patrice Lumumba and why? We merely want to record it in the annals of African history. We want to know how an African leader, a liberator, came to be assassinated. Who killed him? We want our sons to be able to read the history of how Patrice Lumumba, the hero of Congo's liberation struggle, was assassinated. We want to know the facts, even 50 years on. That is one file that should be reopened. And who killed Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld? Who fired on his aeroplane in 1961 and why? And then there's the assassination of United States President Kennedy in 63. We want to know who killed him and why. There was someone called Lee Harvey Oswald, who was then killed by one Jack Ruby. But why did he kill him? Jack Ruby, an Israeli, killed Lee Harvey Oswald, who killed Kennedy. Why did this Israeli kill Kennedy's killer? Then Jack Ruby, the killer of the killer of Kennedy, died in mysterious circumstances before he could be tried. We must open the files. The whole world knows that Kennedy wanted to investigate the Israeli Dimona nuclear reactor. This involves international peace and security and weapons of mass destruction. That is why we should open this file.
2 years later, Martin, Gaddafi was dead after that speech.
Yeah, well, he also, the other thing that he was doing, which they didn't like, was the creation of the Libyan gold dinar, which was a direct threat to the use of the franc in the franc in the West Africa by the, you know, the francophone zone, the franc zone. Basically, he's clearly, from the Western point of view, a problematic figure, and that's why he's been removed to the, and of course, Libya today is in the happy state that Iraq is and Afghanistan, and of course, there's a potential for further war to spill over from Libya, and it already has spilled over into sub-Saharan Africa.
So, before we finish, just a few, one or two. I mentioned that doctors in South Korea are calling for flu vaccinations to be paused after 25 deaths. The authorities, though, say the program has got no direct links between the deaths and the vaccines. Well, that's not what the families of the dead think in South Korea. Also this week, the police have been told not to download the NHS COVID-19 app. As I've also seen as well from contacts in the National Health Service, that actually NHS workers have been told not to download the NHS COVID-19 app either, although it's not entirely clear why. They've just been told not to do it. And going back to Liverpool, Martin, I was actually looking on various search engines on their news section, looking for gyms and Liverpool, and I had to actually go to the Liverpool Echo itself to find the article. So the search engines were not letting me find it. But the fact is that gyms in Liverpool City region will be able to reopen as government agrees to change restrictions. The Metro Mayor says the government have agreed to bring restrictions in line with other Tier 3 areas. Gyms across the Liverpool City region are set to reopen after the government agreed to standardise its Tier 3 lockdown restrictions. Metro Mayor Steve Rotherham confirmed that Whitehall bosses have listened to the arguments put forward by him and fellow local leaders. There's been widespread anger across the region that gyms and leisure centres were forced to close as the region was placed into the highest tier of the government's new lockdown. Now, this all happened, Martin, because one gym owner refused to close, was fined, and then he found money flooding in to pay the fines. So this was really an untenable way to force the gym to lock down.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we can see, there is now massive confusion across the country.
But isn't it more important in the confusion is the mistrust. Andy Burnham was talking about this as well. Mm-hmm. The people just simply do not trust what the government is telling them to do. They don't trust the figures and they don't trust the policy. And one of the main reasons for that, of course, is the government is refusing to give the actual evidence that it's using in order to make these decisions.
Well, I mean, what became clear is that they ignored what the SAGE committees were telling them. And the other thing, of course, which massively undermined the government was the trip to Barnard Castle by Dominic Cummings. They lost 20% support in the opinion polls in a week.
And also, of course, the booting out of Neil Ferguson, the guy behind the lockdown, who it was quite clear that he didn't believe in it himself. And, of course, he's massively paid by Bill Gates and by the John Hopkins University. The figures that came from John Hopkins University here, Imperial College, was taking loads of bungs from Bill Gates to come up with these models, which he didn't himself believe. So, final item tonight is David Livingston, and I spoke to him yesterday. And again, a long version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk on his book Order Ab Chao, which he says himself here is a culmination of much of his previous work, looking at really the history of the occult and these fake versions of Christianity, Islam and Judaism, particularly in order to control religion and hopefully, it's a rather a nasty idea, hopefully to control a massive war to happen, a religious war in the future. So here's David Livingston really talking about some of the links between the Zionist Theodore Herzl and the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley and his OTO.
So I've got some very important findings in my latest book, because I hit at it on my previous books, but I've explored it with much further detail. So it's actually, what were just suspicions before are now almost proven. So basically what's fascinating is that the evangelical movement in particular was heavily influenced by Count Zinzendorf. And Count Zinzendorf basically is the founder of the Moravian Church, who was basically in a Sabbatian front, Sabbatian and Rosicrucian front. They organized, they exercised a profound influence on the revivalist movement in the United States. And that's another tangent. In fact, what's interesting, there's a revivalist movement was very much behind abolitionism in the United States, pitted against the pro-slavery movement, which was very much spearheaded by Skull and Bones and the Ku Klux Klan, of which Albert Pike was involved. But that's another tangent. But I also trace then the more modern development of the evangelical movement, particularly early Christian Zionist movement, and its very close association with Sabbatians and Zionists, and very suspiciously, the Golden Dawn. Like, to give you a hint, to give you a clue, Dracula, Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, he was a member of the Golden Dawn, and it was based on the vampire culture of the area of Transylvania. His main advisor was a Hungarian scholar whose name was Armin van Buuren. He was not only one of the key founders of Pan-Turkism, which was also a Sabbatian movement, but also of the Shambhala myth. And he was a friend of Theodore Herzl.
Is it interesting, Martin, that Aleister Crowley, the so-called Antichrist of the 1930s and 40s, was so closely linked to the Zionists? I was surprised to hear.
Well, I mean, don't forget that people can be linked to all sorts of different things, can't they? I mean, famous people often tend to know each other for various reasons, don't they?
Just by accident.
Not just by accident. There are networks of influence. We all know this.
I mean, he's talking really here about fake movements within faiths and religions, particularly the Kabbalists and the Zionists within Judaism, for example.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously got his own perspective on what's going on. He sees
the idea is to spend lots of money and occupy these faiths. That's effectively what that's about.
That's well. Then you know, you've just summarised what his argument is. It's a very, I would argue that there's an awful lot of academic research goes on into all of these things, and the idea that everything is just coordinated by one vast conspiracy of people who are transhumanists and they've been infiltrating everything forever.
Well, he talks about the Fascist Internationale, for example.
Yes.
Well, there is obviously organisations like the CERC, which are effectively representing them.
There are clearly organisations which are trying to influence events. But the idea that they're all traceable to one particular ideology, I think, is questionable. I'll put it most stronger than that. We know that there are definite people, things going on out there, people trying to steer things, psychological warfare officers, the intelligence agencies and military establishments of the world exist for a reason. They exist to try and, make reality go in the directions they want them to go in. But the fact is that there's actually more than one power center out there. And basically what's going on is a constant struggle to try and obtain resources and power.
So I'll put a link up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, to David Livingstone's latest book, Ordo Ab Kao, which is the motto of the Scottish Rite Freemasons, and our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So thanks very much for bearing with us. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests in the first hour and the second hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Like Craig Murray and many others, I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Don't forget the clocks go back tomorrow evening. We are rebroadcast, allegedly, on the Richie Allen stream at richieallen.co.uk and at Radio Q, as of this week, at noon on
someday. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.